show. Head on to Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! The ninth day of August is what it is, 2013. It is the end of the week. It is Friday on the front porch. Supper is over here at the Kincaid Mansion. And it's time to just kind of kick our boots up on the porch rail and get a nice pull out of the jug or maybe a glass of sweet tea, a little lemonade. Cuss and discuss as the week comes to a close and I face 2 days of enforced silence and, well, not quite solitude, but just, you know, no show. And we come to the end of this week, still trying to dig out of July's hole. We're getting close, getting closer, but last night was a step, it was a tough step. Thanks to Thomas for helping out last night. It was much appreciated, but it makes us face the end of the week. From down inside a $420 deep hole. So it's 420 on Friday on the front porch, and some of you will get a giggle out of that. Kind of appropriate, I guess, isn't it? 420 on the front porch. 42 folks, 10 bucks a piece. Any way we can make it work out is fine. But frankly, when the holes get like this, that means starting the new week comes with, well, who knows what the new week might bring? I don't want to think about it. PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com. So, too, is the traditional mail address by which you can help out if you're not. Well, and I understand not being into PayPal. That's fine. But the traditional mail address is The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318. Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, W-V, 25801. Well, sure, Sergi. Anytime. You know, you don't have to ask. That'll be just fine. Like I said, we just finished supper here at the mansion. We were out running errands earlier today, Agnes and I, and on the way home, we drove by the little local grocery store. And, you know, they've got those signs by the road with the little lights and the arrow pointing toward where the whatever message is. And you learn a little bit about the dangers of abbreviations, really. As we drove by, I noticed, and I pulled right in, because you can't just drive by something like this, the sign for the sales going on at our little grocery store said, ass or pork chops, $1.88 a pound. Well, for the pork chop side of it, it sounds like $1.88 is a pretty good price, so I wheeled right in. And I'm just hoping that what I had for dinner a few minutes ago, prepared by my beloved spouse, Agnes, I'm hoping I got the pork chops. Because, you know, ass chops just doesn't, but that's the way they were. Ass or pork chops, $1.88 a pound. Really hope I got the pork chops. We'll just have to cross our fingers. What do we got this evening? Well, when you start out with ass or pork chops, it can really only get better, can't it? We've got, hey, look, there's Louis Gohmert. Shh. Nobody make any, nobody, no sudden moves and no loud noises. We don't want to scare him away. Yeah, Louis was invited by the Longview Chamber of Commerce of Longview, Texas, to address them. And frankly, God only knows why, but they did. Louis, who gets uppity when people cast aspersions on his asparagus, Louis, who worries daily and deeply about the plight of hard-working Americans who can't afford king crab legs like them food stamp moochers can. Well, Louis went to talk immigration to the Longview Chamber of Commerce in Longview, Texas. We'll leave this to Louis.
Great to be back here at Pinecrest.
The Pinecrest Country Club at Longview, Texas, apparently has absolute shit for a PA system. Let's see.
Especially among friends. And I look around the room, and actually, I was having a flashback sitting here.
He was having a flashback. You know, asparagus can do that to you under certain circumstances.
Right here, we had a debate back in 2004. Keith, you were moderating that and did a nice job. I think it worked out pretty good.
I don't have the stomach for this, nor do I have the ears. So I'll just cut to the chase. If you wait long enough through that intolerable video audio clip, you'll get to the point where Louis says, and I'd like to keep having fruit. I'm a big fruit fan. So people say, you are one. But no, I'd like to keep having that. It's apparently a fruit word salad. He was apparently trying to allay the fears of Texas farmers who cannot make money farming stuff unless they have migrant workers to work in their fields for pathetically, miserably low wages. So even though Louis would like to keep having fruit because he's a big fruit fan, and he'd like to keep having that, he did have to go ahead and tell the assembled civic leaders of the Longview Chamber of Commerce in Texas that until we secure the border, we're going to have the same problems. They're not going away until we control who comes in. The FBI director has confirmed more than once that we know that there are radical Islamists that change their names to Hispanic-sounding last names. They come to Mexico and get an ID, and some of them even learn a little bit of Spanish so that they can try to act as if they're Hispanic. Why? Because we don't have any fear of Hispanics coming into the country, but we got concerns about radical Islamists. Concerns. Absolutely concerns. I mean, when one of those folks walks up to you down maybe around down around Brownsville or something, they say, and they walk up to you on the street and they say, Salam alaikum, buenos dias. Well, you know you got yourself a problem. Because we're not scared enough of the Hispanics. We might not be able to keep on having fruit because we are not scared enough of the Hispanics. I don't know exactly. Is there like one of those little things with a Tesla, a little helmet with a Tesla coil coming out of the top, or you know, one of those bzzzt, you know, kind of Frankenstein's lab sort of thing that can tell you whether or not you are being sufficiently terrified by Hispanics? Donde está la Empire State Building? Bzzzt, bzzzt, bzzzt. going to suck when the fruit goes away because we got insecure borders and can't get anybody out there with temporary visas to pick them because we're not scared enough of the Hispanics. Maybe Louis would like to make them all start wearing like little devil costumes while they're out there picking the lettuce or the fruit. Oranges. Grapefruits, even. I'd like to keep having fruit. I'm a big fruit fan, but so people say you are one, but no, I'd like to keep having that. And Louis's concerned, and he's not the only Texan who is concerned. They are apparently deeply concerned about Islamists in Spring Branch, Texas, where there is apparently a mosque, which is terrifying all by itself, I suppose. This is a story coming from the author is Erika Sargent, and she's with click2houston.com, some TV station. Spring Branch Mosque sits next to a road in Spring Branch, the El Farouk Mosque. And all of a sudden, signs went up in the parking areas alongside the mosque. It's apparently the Westview Shopping Center. No Muslim parking in Westview Shopping Center. Your car will be towed. We thought you was a toad. Do not seek the treasure. No, different toad. Really, great big signs. No Muslim parking in Westview Shopping Center. Your car will be towed. Because, you know, all those Muslim cars have little crescents painted on the hoods, kind of like NASCAR, only Muslim, right? And when you hit the horn on a Muslim car, instead of going beep beep, there's a computer device in there that hollers, "Allah Akbar," so you can automatically always know which cars are Muslim cars for when you need to get them towed. Ahmed Hassan said, "I feel sorry for the person who wrote the signs. This is what comes to mind because obviously he has a lot of hate." And there is a little something to point out here. Namely, that if you're worried about your country being overrun by Muslims and you're afraid that you're going to have to live under the Sharia law, which doesn't sound that much different from living under, say, the canon law of the Roman Catholic Church, except maybe it's a little more humane. Well, if you don't want to have that happen, maybe the thing you don't want to do is be real intolerant and make folks all feel all put upon and paranoid. Yara Aboshadi said, "I'm very shocked because we do live in a society that's supposed to be very accepting, and this is what we all preach, that we all have the freedom of religion." Store employees from the shopping center across the street from the mosque, according to this article, did not want to go on camera, but they do admit they get angry when mosque members park in their lot, taking up spots meant for customers. Them worshiping their Allah is getting in the way of us worshiping the almighty dollar. Steve Kwan owns the shopping center. Nobody would own up to putting up the signs. But one worker said Steve Kwan posted it. Steve Kwan said, "I did not put up the signs." So the signs have come down, but the owner of the shopping center still says, they'll be calling a tow truck company to try to get all the cars that shouldn't be parked there out. So I guess the Muslims just have to walk to there. Is there a, it's Texas. It's Spring Branch, Texas. You got to wonder if there's a church nearby. Do they tow Christian cars, too? Why do I think no? But again, I'm just guessing. 15 minutes past the hour, Sergi has dialed in on the... Dialed in. I'm old. Logged in? Signed in? I don't know what... Has Skyped in. There. Has Skyped in on the Skype line. Hey, Sergi, what's happening?
Good evening, Bob. Am I coming in clear?
You're pretty good, yeah.
My apologies. I'm sure you can hear all the fans running in the background.
Is that what that is?
It's fans. It is 110 degrees outside right now.
And you, being burning a smart up. Individual, are inside.
I am inside. There's the AC on. There's two fans in this room. And got to keep cool in this kind of weather.
Absolutely. I mean, it really can. It can get dangerous, whether that's a humid 110 or a dry 110. It can bake you either way.
Down here, it's a humid 110, so it feels
lovely.
Degrees hotter. Oh, yes. The eastern half of Texas, one of the most, it's not quite as bad as the deeper south, but it's still quite humid. It's not Florida humid. But the record for me stands when I walked outside back in 2011. My thermometer read 118 in the shade. And
ouch.
And the humidity, I took out my heat index chart, the humidity and dew point, the heat index was 132.
Oh.
That was not a good day.
Mercy.
And that was all in the shade now, mind you, in the sun.
And you can't, I mean, there's no getting away from that. I mean, can an air conditioner inside even keep up with that?
If you're sitting right on it. Oh my word. But first off, about Louis Gohmert, I gotta say, there's a country club in East Texas. There's apparently a country club in East Texas with a PA system that sounds worse than that on the buses here. Here
and that's saying something.
Let me tell y'all a little bit about the buses here in Fort Worth. We have several models. There's a small and a large one that were originally purchased in the 80s when the transit agency reorganized. There's an early 2000 model. And then there's the ones that they got in 2011, the big fancy articulating buses that bend in the middle. Well, on the 2000 models and on the articulating models, the PA system is crystal clear. But most of the bus routes, especially the secondary ones, use the older buses.
And so all the announcements sound like Linus's teacher, Miss Othmar?
Then add some static, but then add in moments when it is clear. Like, let me see if I can get this right. Grand Plaza.
And you don't know if you're stopping there, going there, passing there.
You don't know either.
Or whether they just announced that the Islamists had parked there.
You don't know if you're on the number 1, the 5, the 25, or the 72. Because all of those stop at LeGrand. But basically, my main point was, I got a little mini story here. So recently, we got a new fridge here at the house. It's one of those big fancy fridges. It's a Frigidaire gallery. It has the LEDs on the inside, and you know it has all these.
Yeah, you open it up and you expect somebody to deal a hand of blackjack.
No, I expect somebody to just hand me a sandwich. Well, you know, just maybe I don't need to get out and make the sandwich myself. The fridge should do it for me.
Over and under with the freezer underneath, or are you side by side?
We've always used side by side. I don't know about y'all, but I've heard the top freezer, bottom ones are more efficient. But we've always used side by side. And In fact, I even had to ask Betsy a question about it because I read the there's apparently a Sabbath mode. It's that fancy.
Basically,
if you're Jewish and observe the Sabbath, you can set the fridge to where when it's opened, the lights don't come on and the compressor doesn't kick in except on a timer. And I never expect, it's just like, it's a fancy fridge.
Wow.
Right. And I picked up, and the reason we got the fridge is because, like, I live with my grandmother. My aunt gets the appliances, the second hand, after my grandmother's done with the washers, the dryers, the fridges, TVs, etc. I made a point of looking in the instruction manual, just reading the manual front to back and making sure everything was in order. Has society seriously degraded to the point where we have to have warnings in instruction manuals such as, and I quote, "Be sure that the location in which you are installing this appliance can support a fully loaded refrigerator." Apparently we have.
Well, I mean, I'm not... This is America, Sergi. And, of course, if this was right-wing radio, do you know what the answer to what you just said would be?
What?
Well, it's because we are such a litigious society, and there's always some tassel-loafer trial lawyer out there trying to torment some poor corporation that's trying to only do its best to provide refrigerators for Americans, but because somebody wasn't smart enough to... And that's why that label is there. I kid you not.
Oh, I don't doubt it. I do not doubt it. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking that the company's just trying to cover its ass, but basically, it just, like, you know, I wanted to wait until the front porch because, you know, it's kind of an open discussion on Fridays. And I just kind of wanted to bring that up. And the crown jewel of it, though, and I was joking around with several, I think I joked around in the Skype group about it as well. But there's another warning in there that says, before moving the refrigerator, be sure you have disconnected the water line leading to the ice maker. And it just popped in my head, an image like a sitcom kind of image.
You put it on, like, the hand truck, you tilt it up, you back it up, and the next thing you know, your kitchen's flooded.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I just saw, like, what's the, like, you know, Vincent Harper from Mama's Family or something trying to move, you know, some stereotypically dumb sitcom character trying to move the fridge. Like, oh.
Well, just give it a little bit. It's probably stuck on the rug. Just tug it a little harder. Snap. Oh, yeah. Oh. Well, see, I'm sitting here. I'm sitting here thinking what a lovely job your new fridge would probably do at keeping our package of ass or pork chops nice and fresh until we're ready to cook them up again tomorrow.
Shoot, I don't know. Oh yeah, speaking of that,
I actually took a photo for those who don't. I'd have to tweet it or something. But yes, ass or pork chops, $1.88 a pound.
Oh, please post that on Facebook. I want to share that. A lot of people on my list get a kick out of that.
All right. You twisted my arm.
But basically, I don't know, though. Ass chops do sound pretty good.
Well, you know, I saw that Tony Bourdain episode where he ate it belonged to a warthog, and he said he'd never been so sick in all of his life, so... I don't know.
I don't know. That reference kind of flew over my head. Who is he?
Tony Bourdain, that did the travel cook guy, traveled to Africa and ate warthog asshole.
That's a thing?
That's a thing. And well, said he'd never gotten so sick in all his life.
Well, I bet. I mean, it's where everything comes out. I think you get pretty sick from that.
You would think.
Though but then again, I mean, I eat hot dogs and sausage, and I'm sure that...
Well, you know, it was Bismarck who said there are two things in life you don't want to see made, law and sausages.
Law, sausages, and... hot dogs.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure hot dogs are worse than sausage. But basically, and, you know, seeing those warnings got me thinking. And so I picked up the, like, there's a rider guide you can get for people who take the buses around here. And I just read it, just thinking, I'm going to see if this, there were literally step-by-step directions in the rider guide on how to get on a bus. Welcome aboard. As you board at the front, drop the exact cash fare into the fare box, then have a seat.
Beautiful.
Is that really necessary? I guess it is if I have to put it in there.
You know, this is America. You just can't assume anything anymore, Sergey. And by the way, the photograph is, I have just tweeted it, so it will pop up on my Facebook feed momentarily. Ass or pork chops? Friday supper.
Can I have both?
Well, you know, see, that's the thing. I looked at them in the meat case, and I couldn't tell which was which, so I'm just kind of hoping.
Well, I'm sure a lot of pork comes off the pig's ass anyway, so... Meat's meat. You know, I just... All that processed stuff, you never know if it's...
Yeah, don't ever read the ingredients label to potted meat.
Oh, that reminds me. My late great aunt, Lord rest her soul, she was fond of... She was fond of potted meat. Ate so much of it. How can you eat that stuff? But the one thing that she wouldn't eat was Vienna sausage.
I see. At that point in time, you're pursuing a distinction without a difference. By the way, in the chat room there, Stockton Larry noted that there's also a warning from years back in Winnebago recreational vehicles about not leaving the driving seat when the coach is in motion. That happened when a woman set the cruise control on the RV and then went back to have a snack.
Did she think it was autopilot?
Apparently.
He thought the thing would drive itself, I suppose. And, oh, and he also said, Ralph Nader once labeled the hot dog America's most dangerous guided missile. That sounds like Ralph Nader, all right.
It probably is. It just, you don't want to see them made, but they can be yummy.
I have to dispute that, though. America's most dangerous guided missile, those damn wasps. I cannot go outside.
The white Anglo-Saxon Protestants? Oh, no, you mean the bugs.
I mean, although, yes, those, never mind. But, yes, I do mean the bugs. I have been fighting a war on wasps. Oh, ever since.
We had an outbreak of sand hornets not too long back here, and they are those are some terrifying, I mean, they look like yellow jackets on, I don't know, baseball level steroids. I mean, they're all beefed up.
Y'all are getting sand hornets all the way up there now?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
In fact, I've got a queen. We captured a queen and kept her in a jar. It was she was buzzing around here in the studio one afternoon and causing no small amount of havoc, and I just happened to have a quart mason jar, and that's what we trapped her in. And I looked her up, and, yeah, that's what she was. But then again, like I said, you know, there I was during the heat wave in D.C., and those giant palmetto bug cockroaches that, you know, you're not supposed to have in D.C. were there. And I don't think they were tourists. They'd come to stay.
Don't even get me started on the roaches. About a couple weeks ago, I killed a roach. I took a picture. Here's the thing. It was two roaches that were somehow mutated together.
Ew!
And I after I killed it, I took a picture. I put a ruler beside it and took a picture. And if I recall correctly, the thing was about three or four inches long, somewhere in that neighborhood.
I did something similar. I had one that wanted to pose for me in Washington, D.C., Sergey, and I set a dime down next to it for scale, and it dwarfed the dime.
Mm. And see, the ones in D.C., like, were they the ones that flew?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, those are the worst. Like,
oh, yeah, it just gave me the horrors.
The one that I saw was flying as well. Not only was it two mutated roaches together that were 2, 3, 4 inches long, but it flew into the room. Now,
that, yeah, that's when you feel like you're probably a little outnumbered.
Now, you know, for anyone who's seen the pictures I take, you know, I kind of do the faux street look on my pictures, and I try to look tougher than I really am, but get me around bugs, and I am screaming like, oh, it's like...
Yeah, my son Ferg is terrified. Just, you know, there's no rhyme or reason to how people are. My son Ferg is terrified not of butterflies, but of moths. I mean, he will get the screaming horrors if a moth flies into the room. And God forbid one should fly near him. He'll climb the walls. I don't know why. Yeah. He doesn't either.
Yeah, see, I would be running. Like, wasps or moths and butterflies are cool by me, but most any other bug, I will bolt out of that room faster than a Republican at an NAACP convention. I can't do roaches. I can't do spiders. I can't do wasps. Bees are fine, because as long as you leave bees alone, they won't bother you.
But yeah, the wasps, yellow jackets are the meanest, though.
Like, wasps, though, will go after you. You can be not even minding that wasp, and the thing will sit up here and just dive bomb you. And the same goes with anything in that wasp family.
So I'm guessing they're loving the 130 heat index, 110 in the shade, right?
Oh, yes, they are. They are, in fact, the butterflies aren't even active except in the very early morning and the very early evening. The bees aren't active either during the day. The bees have more sense than to be out in the heat. They wait till when the sun is setting. But the wasps are out and about, and they are ruling the skies. They are, in fact, I
and they've got an attitude.
I exterminated a big nest on the porch, and they're already trying to rebuild. There's another nest appearing on one of the side windows by the driveway. It's a constant. I'm almost out of spray again. And then maybe you or one of the other listeners know. Last night I saw a bug I never saw before.
Really?
I was playing Saints Row 3, or Saints Row the 3rd, rather. So, like, the lights were off, except for the little ramp here, and I was in the zone, and I ran out of Kool-Aid. I needed to refill my glass. And so I paused the game, and I flicked the room light on, and I turned around in my chair here at the computer, and hanging from the ceiling by a string of web was not a spider, or at least not the typical spider. It was about a fourth of an inch long, black as night, and it resembled a very, very, very small crab. It had little pincers like a crab that come out on the side, and it had the little ovular center.
Wow.
There's a window opposite the door that leads out the room. I almost crashed through the window.
was there screaming involved, Sergi?
Yes. High-pitched screaming, too.
Yes.
And, like, have you ever seen a bug that looks like that?
I'm looking it up now.
I have not seen. It's like, does it? In fact, I'm kind of monitoring the chat room, and maybe somebody can email us. Like, I want to know what this bug is. It's like, and I got a book. And I normally do this with spiders I see hanging anyway. I got a book, and I slammed the book on it to kill it. Like, I opened it halfway, and then I slammed it back shut.
I can tell you this. At the eBug Pest Control Forum, it's okay. At the eBug Pest Control Forum, there's a lot of people. A lot of people have asked questions. The bug is a pseudoscorpion. They're harmless unless you're a tiny bug. They mainly live in dead leaf litter and other moist places outdoors. They're unknown to most people who don't poke around in leaf litter.
Okay, so at least they're, it's maybe harmless, but it was scary. And to answer Larry in the chat room, it was 6 legs, just like a crab.
Yeah.
It's like a pseudo-scorpion. Yeah, but it's definitely pseudo, because it ain't like any other scorpion I've ever seen. Oh, that thing gave me the creeps, and normally I sleep in the dark. I left the lamp and the ceiling lights on.
Yeah, and these are people, this list I'm looking at here are people writing in from California, Oklahoma, there's Texas. So, yeah.
I've never seen.
Apparently they get around.
Lord, these bugs. I do not do bugs. It's, I'm gonna conclude my call so I don't take up all the time, but one final point I just want to make. This is kind of a little more comedy on the kind of the same level as those warnings. They're on Rink. By the way, anyone looking for a good laugh, rinkworks.com, RINKWORKS.com. They have this entire section called Things People Said, and they have another section called Computer Stupidities, and it's just full of stories of just dim-witted people who ain't got a clue. And, of course, they had to have a special section just for computers. And in the Things People Said section, there is a category called Questions Asked the Forest Rangers in National Parks. And there's this one family that went for a hike, and they left a comment card with a request on it for one of the rangers. And the comment card said, and I quote, "It was nice, but there's too many bugs and creepy crawlies. Can y'all please spray the wilderness?"
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
You could tell that was a city dweller just like me.
Well, it's like the story of the little city dwelling boy that went to his first camp out, and he'd been just tormented by, apparently it was in Minnesota or Alaska or something where they have mosquitoes the size of eagles. And he'd been tormented by mosquitoes all day, and then at night he crawled into his tent and zipped it shut, and he saw a firefly light up for the first time, and he immediately picked up his little cell phone and called home and said, "Mommy, I want to come home. The mosquitoes been eating me all day, and now they're coming after me with flashlights."
Oh, man. You know, when I was a kid, I used to see fireflies all the time. Now, I hardly see them. I see them maybe once every 3 years. I don't know what happens to all the fireflies around here. But I used to see, when I was a kid, they used to just light up the night sky. And I live near downtown. They used to just light up the night sky. Now they don't. I guess it must be pesticides. Same thing that's happening with the bees. I've been having to self-pollinate my cucumber plants because there ain't been much any bees around.
How are your cucumbers doing?
Oof. The heat is scorching them. Cucumbers are tropical plants, but when that temperature gets above 90 to 95, they get stunted. And sure enough, this 100 plus is... I've been keeping them watered and everything. This 100 plus is too much for them. I've gotten one cucumber so far.
Wow.
It's just, even they can't stand the heat, and they're native to, like, the subcontinent of India.
Wonder how folks' chilies are doing. You'd think they'd be loving this heat.
Chilies?
Yeah.
The restaurant?
No, the peppers.
The peppers. Oh, I don't know. I've never grown those. I don't know about those.
Oh, you haven't lived till you've made your own hot sauce, Sergi.
Yeah, but I'm not too much of a fan of spice.
Oh, you're not spicy food. Okay.
But
born and bred native Texan, don't care much for spicy stuff. You'll lose your Texan card that way.
Well, I kind of have an excuse. Like when I eat spicy, I get a real upset stomach. It's kind of the same thing that happens because, like, I have a lot of food allergies. Like, I can't eat nuts of any kind. I can't eat avocados. I can't eat mushrooms. And
so but cucumber, but you can eat cucumbers, and your cucumbers are burning up.
Oh yeah, I love cucumbers, and I love pickles.
Oh, cucumbers with a nice fresh sweet onion sliced up and. A little white vinegar, sugar, water mix. You let the ice cubes melt, and it's for the water. Oh, yeah.
I definitely have to try that sometime.
Oh, that's a midsummer staple on gardening home dinner tables around here. Just a little bit of white vinegar and some water and a couple of ice cubes to melt in it, and salt and a little bit of sugar and sliced up cucumber and thinly sliced onion. Heaven.
Oh, and by the way, Larry in the chat room, Stockton Larry, yes, we have brown recluses down here, and I'd rather not think about them.
You'll have nightmares.
Oof, yeah, I don't do the, I hate to take up work time, but yeah, this reminds me. My grandmother grew up in Marshall, Texas, EDP, Texas, and she had, she and her family down there had an outhouse. It's before the indoor plumbing reached that area. Had an outhouse that they had to go to. When I was little, she used to tell me horror stories.
Yeah, and outhouses are brown recluse country.
It's like she would tell me those stories of seeing black widows and brown recluses, and the cherry on top was how she mentioned that they couldn't afford any toilet paper, so they had to use the Sears catalog.
Absolutely. That's just typical Poe folks behavior, because there was actually an outhouse on this property for years. I mean, up until I was probably a teenager. And yes, there was always a Sears catalog outside.
It makes me thankful for indoor plumbing and toilet paper. It's like I am thankful for those luxuries as long as I live. And yes, Duncan, I put pickles on my donut burgers.
Holy mackerel.
Yeah, slice a glazed donut in half, you know, have two halves, put a meat, beef or chicken patty in there, some cheese, some mayonnaise, onions, pickles, and tomatoes. That's a real treat.
You know what? I really can't disagree. That sounds absolutely delightful.
And thank you, Bob, because like Lottie thought it was the most disgusting thing ever.
No. We're a broad-minded food porn organization here. Some of this goes all the way back to when, Kate was working down on the Gulf Coast and called in one evening in a positive rapture, Sergi, because some of the Gulf Coast folks down there had introduced her to the concept of putting a few drops of Crystal hot sauce on your vanilla ice cream. And you know what? It's right tasty.
But yeah, thank you. I definitely enjoyed this call, Bob. Thank you for taking the call. And I just wanted to call in this Friday on the front porch to just kind of bring a little more lighthearted.
Absolutely, because there's been some grim stuff out there this week.
It's not just this week. Over the course of this whole summer, I have gotten politics fatigue, I've gotten news fatigue, and so, you know, I saw that stuff in the fridge, instruction manual, and I just said, I'm gonna call in Friday, open talk, and I'm just gonna, cause I'm sure I'm not the only one who has fatigue, and I'm just gonna bring a little light-hearted, fun kind of conversation to the table, because I haven't watched the news in days or went to any news sites, and so, just to lighten the mood, just to give everybody a little break. So
well, hopefully you're proving inspirational, Sergi. So we'll talk soon, I hope. You take care.
You too, Bob. Thank you.
All right. Later. It's our buddy Sergi calling from Fort Worth. Please bear in mind, sooner or later, a lot of us meet each other. Just don't go anywhere with Sergi where there might be bugs, spiders. Just be humane that way. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob.
Hey, what do you know?
Well, you guys got me going. I was just quickly remembered.
Just sitting there minding your own business.
Yeah.
And
well, I'm walking back in the woods with the fishing rod in my hand to a pond, and man, I stepped on a yellow jacket ground nest.
Oh, aren't those a joy?
Oh, man, I never knew I could dance like that, backwards. Man, was I moving. I mean, that's my second wife, so she never saw me move so fast in my life.
And you know, people will do crazy things with the, I saw a guy one time. You know, there's and now that we know more than it used to be traditional that the way you got rid of a yellow jacket's nest was you poured a little gasoline down the hole in the ground.
Yeah, that would work, yes.
Because it would asphyxiate them, right?
Yeah.
Well, this one guy that I knew did not know that the purpose, that the gasoline by itself would asphyxiate him, so he poured the gasoline down the nest and then threw a match.
Oh, man.
It was inspiring. I mean, I won't lie.
He was moving even faster than he did.
Well,
they came out after him.
Yeah, the gasoline went up just about as "what are you" was coming out of my mouth.
Oh man, yeah, that happens to me a few times. That I was going to say something, and as it came out, it was like, "Oh brother."
And see, this wasn't even one of those rednecky kind of "hey y'all, watch this."
Yeah. Well, I've been listening. Jim with Lil Green, he had his finger on something. That those female singers were really, really a strong part of blues in the 20s and 30s, and they were backed up by, hell, guys like Louis Armstrong were playing behind them.
Oh, sure.
In recording sessions, you know, it was great stuff. And then Kevin called, and he made a remark about, you know, how I usually go back into history and dredge stuff up. Because my theory about that whole thing is that things stay changed, but they always remain the same. You see, I'm working a book right now, Castles of Steel, which is a chronicle of the British and German high seas fleet during World War One. And, man, that was their, you know, that was like, that was their, the real way of putting your outreach on somebody else was with those kind of ships. And controlling situations was done that way. And I really feel that things, the more they, what's the old saying, the more they change, the more they stay the same, Bob?
That's about it, yeah.
Because you guys were talking, I think last night, about the, there's a good book called, no, it was Rick Smith. They're talking about the, no, somebody even later than that, about the Cuban Missile Crisis, because there's an excellent study called 2 Minutes to Midnight that I had on Talking Book stuff a few years back, and did that wake me up, because I lived through it and didn't know what was really going on. I mean, no, they weren't telling us what was going on. You know, you're getting the news, and that's all the shit that fits we print, you know, that kind of stuff. Because what you heard and what was really happening, two different things. Man, the U.S. was ready to come out of Guantanamo with Marines, and Curtis LeMay was screaming for war, and
well, when didn't he?
Yeah, true. But here we didn't know what the Russians were.
Wasn't the General Jack D. Ripper character from Dr. Strangelove based on,
yes,
Curtis,
sir,
LeMay?
Yep, that's it. I mean, he did the job that he was given to do in World War II. We know, with the firebombing of Japan, etc. But still doesn't mean I have to like it.
No, and we did. There's a strain within the flyboy, the air services, whether it was Army Air Corps or later on the Air Force, I don't know quite how to characterize it, but remember Billy Mitchell. Remember Billy Mitchell?
Oh yeah.
Billy Mitchell wanted, at the end of the First World War, there was this developing concept of air power, air supremacy.
Yeah.
And how you could drop things that went boom on people from great heights.
Yeah, and how you could get there with the aircraft carriers, et cetera. Yeah.
And not just that, but this idea of carrying armaments, carrying bombs attached to aircraft, was kind of novel, and there were some people who said, "Billy Mitchell, you're crazy." And he said, "Look over there." It's about 1921, mind you.
Yep.
"Look over there. Look at all them miners that are rising up against perfectly good, decent, God-fearing coal companies and corporations. You know what? I'll take some of my airplanes, and I'll fly them over, and I'll bomb those miners, and I'll prove to you how effective aerial bombardment is."
God, yes.
And so, yes, they yes, that happened.
That was the biggest change between the wars, was the aerial bombing brings the civilians right in. Get a good seat for the action here, folks. Yeah, that's In fact, a buddy of mine's father was a newsman here in Cleveland, a guy who played drums for me for a while, and this guy had the pleasure, when they brought when the station he worked for brought the Beatles to Cleveland, he had the pleasure of sitting and playing cards with John Lennon one evening, and Lennon was full of stories about being in England. You know, well, Lennon was born in 40.
Yeah.
So by the time the buzz bombs were hitting in 44 or so, you know, he got a good taste of that. So, yeah, but there's always some guy who's ready to, you know, to just take it to somebody else and not think about it. Even Marshall, who I have a lot of respect for, George Marshall, but, you know, he talked about using atomic weapons if we had to land on Kyushu. Soften them up with atomic weapons and then send your people marching over the beaches.
Yeah, the radioactive beaches.
Yeah, people just don't know sometimes what they're saying. But I got a kick out of you two guys talking about the bug situation because the apartment I'm living in is a war zone, and me, boric acid is my weapon of defense against critters. You know, I found that out when I was living in a place where two guys thought they were interior decorators, and I just moved in, and I'm sitting there reading one night, and I'm hearing noise from behind us. These guys had put up shopping bags on the wall and crisscrossed them with furring strips. And you guess what was behind that paper?
Grocery bags yuck.
Because the critters like the glue in the grocery bags. And, man, I'm in a big apartment now, and there's, you know, you get people, one person gets them, and, man, you're fighting them all over the building. And I'm so clean with food, man. There's no way they're going to, you know, there's nothing for them to eat, but they're hard to get rid of. And I hate the damn things. But, you know, that's another story. But what had me think when you were talking last night about folks who left the South looking for work? There was a classic joke. A guy dies and gets to heaven, and St. Peter's giving him the guided tour. And he takes him in one section. There's a bunch of guys listening to Strauss and drinking beer, and well, this is the German section. And you go over there, the guy's eating pasta and dancing the tarantella, you know, and all this Italian section. And he gets the guy to tour, and he gets to one section, and there's people chained to a post, and they're pulling on the chains. And the guy says, well, St. Peter, what's that about? He says, well, all these guys, they're from West Virginia and Kentucky, and it's a weekend, and they want to go home. Yeah, you did appreciate that.
Yeah, I got that.
Because that's the old joke would be, don't try to go east-west, cross a north-south highway on a weekend. Because the guys were rolling out of Detroit and Cleveland and Akron and all the places you mentioned. And God bless them. You know, there was a guy, Kentucky neighbor of mine, he taught me, man, he checked.
Well, you can take the hillbilly out of the mountains, but you can't take the mountains out of the hillbilly.
Well, that's the way people used to be, home and family. The family seems to have disappeared, the cousins and the aunts and the uncles and the extended family. You don't see that much anymore.
You know, were you ever able to get Joe Bajant's Rainbow Pie on an audiobook?
Mm-hmm.
Did that just resonate? Did that have resonance with you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because he spoke so honestly and so straightforwardly about the destruction of the extended family in favor of the so-called nuclear family.
Nuclear family, yeah. Yep. Yeah, there's a lot of humor involved with about people from going here from, you know, I said that the other day that about the singers in Bakersfield, do they know where they came from? And why they ended up in Bakersfield, a lot of them?
I don't know if people do or not, and I'm not sure I'm completely on it.
Well, it's the idea of the Okies heading west out of the Dust Bowl and out of the poverty levels of the South. I used to know a guy here in Cleveland he was a talk show host, a guy named, he called himself Gary D. And he learned from the guy Pine, Joe Pine was one of his influences. And Gary was a great guy, and he'd sit around and he'd come down to hear me, and we talked a lot, and I kept saying, Gary, you know, people have forgotten how poor at some time in their family's existence that they have been. I mean, for God's sake, me and Rick Smith share that in common as projects. I lived in ones that were built in 39 and moved into them when I was kid and moved out when I was in my late teens. And they were different in those days. I mean, there was the lack of money was spread out all over the map culturally. You know, there was a lot of people working. I worked in knitting factories. Repaired machine hat in 1905, people sweater. It was people. We had folks come in there from after the Hungarian Revolution, and moved into the projects. It was just you know, people of all. There was one common denominator, a thing called not a lot of money. But the guys who were working at jobs that just didn't they didn't pay much then, but now you can't even get them because you want to work in the garment industry. Like I told Rick, I belonged to the ILGW when I was 16 years old. You know, and during the after school and during the holiday, you know, the summer holidays, working in these shops. Garment Workers Union. Delivered milk for a living for a while. Another disappearing job. That job had its points, though, I'll tell you. Nothing like working in a neighborhood where there's a lot of young women with single girlfriends. And I was like 21. You got to meet this one. You got to meet that one. No thanks. You know, I'm out of here. I'm not in a hurry.
Hence the origin of the jokes about the milkman.
Oh, yeah. Well, hell, my mom's oldest brother, when he took that job, and he was still driving a horse and wagon that far back.
Well, you know the, well, maybe there's this old joke about the milkman shows up to deliver the morning's, make the morning's delivery. Knocks on the door, and a beautiful woman answers the door, and she says, "You want to come in?" And he says, "Sure." And she says, "Well, come on into the kitchen. You want some breakfast?" And he says, "Well, that'd be great." And she sits him down to this full-course breakfast, you know, pancakes, eggs, bacon, the works. He's had a lovely breakfast, and she says, "You want to come upstairs and fool around?" And he says, "Well, sure." And so they go upstairs, and wonderful, you know, morning passage of bliss. And then they go back downstairs, and at the door, she hands him a $20 bill. And he says, "What's this for?" She says, "Well, it's Christmas, and I asked my husband what we should do about the milkman, and he said, 'Screw him, give him $20. Breakfast was my idea.'"
Yeah, I remember that when he got toward the punchline. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I heard that, but that was, I had one customer kind of half pull that on me when I got to the house and she owed me $17.
Careful, you're going to get another email from Isaac about Santa Claus.
Oh, not again. I'll tell you that story sometime, Bob. I don't know how or when, but it's not perfect if you're up to it. If you've met a lot of women in your life, things aren't hard to figure out. And I was blessed in those days, and thank God, you know, being at my age now, you know, I'm so old I can't even think about it anymore. You know, it's
but forgotten who gets tied up.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but you know, get back to this. What was I talking about? That you disrupted my train of thought isn't on the tracks anymore. Sometimes. But yeah, milk or television was another thing. You were talking about, you talking about dogs. I went into work on a woman's TV, and I'm down there on, you know how those consoles where you're down there with your head inside the unit and
oh sure,
yeah, tubes and yeah, blah blah. And I'm pulling my head out, and I turn around, and I'm face to face with a Great Dane. Oh my God, did that make a believer out of me in a hurry? Because they're huge when you're, you know, down at head level with them, and you, all you can see is that mouth. It's, I'm like, I'm a dog man. My apartment walls are covered with them. I was a guy who lived in a neighborhood where every time you turned around, there was one looking for. And I liked them because they chased people out of my house one time and saved me trouble. You know, I didn't have to get out of. I didn't. I was half in the bag, and if I just staggered out of bed, I was liable to shoot myself. You know, it's like. The hell with the things. And I went out the next day, and borrowed a wholesale card and went to an alarm place and bought an old-fashioned point-to-point burglar alarm. You know, it cost me $100-some, but I could have added smoke detectors and you name it. I could have added everything to it, except maybe the thing that detects crooked politicians.
Yeah, I don't think,
you don't need a machine. You figure that out yourself.
It comes to you pretty quick, I think.
Yeah, this book on these you know, the Germans started World War One with the fewest submarines of anybody. Britain, France, Russia, and the U.S. had more of them, the U-boats. And they said, one of my best friends in the world's father was a lieutenant in the World War II bunch on a German sub. And his son took him to see Das Boot, and he said the old man was practically having a breakdown. He could just lean over and say, I can smell the sub from here, because he was so young. And it was but he was given the offer either a tour of the Soviet Union or the U-boats. It's a hell of an offer, isn't it?
That's the devil. That's literally the devil in the deep blue sea.
Yeah, you got no choice there. But again, you know, I know Kevin. A lot of folks, they don't understand that. To me, now maybe I'm wrong, and you can help me with this. My theory about history: the clothes change, the weaponry changes, but the goddamn ridiculousness of the evil of so-called leadership stays the same. The greed, the money, the power. That is the guiding force behind a lot of these people. Because you certainly prove it with people like, what's his name? Louis
Gohmert?
Yeah, that guy's dumb in a box of rocks. No doubt about it. I mean, and people elect this guy?
And they just clap and clap and clap. Hey, before we go much further, I wanted to recommend a book for you. You might be able to get it on an audio CD. I'm not sure if we've ever discussed it before, but my father bought it. Back during the latter part of his life, after my mother had passed away in 1997, he would kind of sit there by himself, and he'd watch book TV, and he'd see one. And my father was not illiterate. He was a very, very intelligent man. He just didn't care for book reading. Now, he was a great one for the newspaper. It could practically memorize the sports section. But to sit down and do a book, I think it was just, I don't know. It didn't do anything for him.
A lot of folks have trouble with it. I noticed that.
But he would see books discussed on book TV, and he'd run out to the local Books A Million and either get it or order it and have it shipped to me, with a note saying, read this and tell me everything that's in it. And he sent me one time that had tremendous resonance with me. It's a very powerfully written book. It's by James D. Hornfisher of some years back, and you might be able to get it in an audiobook. It's called since you're in sort of a naval mood now as it is.
Yeah.
It's called The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailors.
Oh.
And it is the story of the subtitle is The Extraordinary World War II Story of the U.S. Navy's Finest Hour. And it is the story of the brilliant, you know, if you don't come home victorious, don't come home stand of a group of destroyer escorts, a couple of destroyers, and a few of the so-called jeep carriers, you know, those things that were hung together by spit and baling wire.
Not Leyte Gulf.
Well, no, this is the Surigao Straits.
Okay.
Which is associated with that at the same time that Halsey was out wandering around north of the place.
He was looking for the aircraft carriers.
Right, and, where is the 7th Fleet? The world wonders.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I remember that situation from... There's an English author who has his book was Retribution, which was the last 2 years of war in the Pacific, and he did one on the last two in Europe also that had a one-word name, and Isaac Hastings, his name is Sir Isaac Hastings now. But that was a hell of a time. In fact, what I learned in one of my last go-throughs on Retribution was the off of the Philippines, there was a battle between surface fighters. And two of the ships that were fighting in the American name, one was the California and the other was the West Virginia. And you know where they started the war?
No.
the bottom of Pearl Harbor.
Oh, yes, yeah. And in fact, as I when I was a young man going to school at West Virginia University, the bell of the bell and the mast of that USS West Virginia stood at Ogilvy Plaza, which was right in the heart of the campus.
Well, they brought them up and refit them and equipped them with stuff that was not even in existence when they sunk. And these two, there was a third one that was with them that was one of the... Because those battleships were obsolete by standards of World War II. I mean, the carrier became the big weapon, but the Japanese brought a bunch of ships through the straits and around it, and they were trying to get at the...
And this book speaks to that battle, the Battle of Samar. And if you get it, Bill, you will be absolutely captivated by it.
Well, I know darn well that those jeep carriers put up a hell of a fight against bigger ships down there. I mean, it was Halsey went running. Was it Halsey or was it what you mentioned? Was it Halsey was running the fleet at that time?
Was off. Chasing, well, he was off chasing Japanese disinformation.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, he was trying to catch the... And that's the interesting thing that I learned from that the book on the Germans, when they gave up the Tsingtao, they brought those ships all the way around and they fought. They won one battle off the west coast of of South America, and then they went over to the Falklands, where the British had sent a couple bigger ships out from Europe. And defeated them. There was a German Pacific ships. There was two cruisers and a bunch of smaller ships, three or four. They sailed all around the darn world, and they had no way to get back to the old country. And the damn coaling operations. And I think I mentioned to you, we sent four ships, battleships, to where the British fleet was based in. Some place in the north of England, which is an odd place with islands surrounding a gulf where they brought the... It has a name, and I can't remember it off. I can't remember my own name anymore sometimes. But, Jackie Fisher was the admiral of the British fleet. He was running the naval, you know, him and Churchill. And, did they go nuts when they saw these American ships burning diesel. And they were still burning coal. So, of course, what did they do after the war when Turkey lost? Where did they head? Right for a place called Mesopotamia, which, what will we call that today, Bob?
Yeah, that would be the Iraq.
Yeah, you got it. And the Iraqis fought a war with them off, a guerrilla war and a small war between the end of World War I until 1932. And the British finally had to back off because that... The other thing is we're not taught that the Great Depression was worldwide as far as the industrial states. And my grandmother went back to visit Germany that she had left before 1900, and she brought back a bunch of $100 bills. And, boy, she must have made a killing, right?
Well.
She told my mother you needed a bushel basket of these hundreds to go buy a loaf of bread. People want to know why a guy like Hitler got some control of that country. The Depression was killing a lot of these people. And what I like to tell these right-wingers is how that damn liberal Bismarck got Social Security going in England, in Germany, in the 1880s sometime. Yeah, that was a damn socialist there ever was one, huh?
No. You and I both know that was...
Of course.
Yeah, that was a man smart enough to...
Yeah, give people something to work for.
That has an interesting way of keeping the moneyed classes' heads sitting on top of the moneyed classes' necks.
Yes, sir, because people only take so much. And you know, that Depression era, that change in 29 had such an effect on people who were around me when I was growing up. I heard more stories about what it could be like, you know?
Sure. I mean, I remember very well that the old saying that ran around the old folks of my family, that the Republicans had promised them three meals a day.
Yeah.
And they delivered. oatmeal, skip a meal, and miss a meal.
Great humor. See, this is the kind of humor, it may be sardonic, but it helps you cope with things. Comedy has a way of, you know, sardonic, sarcastic humor is a way to speak the truth and to get a kind of a sick chuckle out of it at the same time. That's what you have to do to keep going. You've got to... But there are people today, and I don't know where they come from, Bob. It's like I heard a discussion of the Civil War, and this guy was talking about if it hadn't been for the blockade, the South would have won the war. Well, the blockade sure didn't help him. But Jesus God, when you look at the industrial capacity of the South in 1860, Bob, and what they were facing with all those damn tin-clad and cheap ironclad ships that controlled the rivers, the Tennessee and the Cumberland.
Yeah, the Cumberland.
The Mississippi. That was a big part of the problem. And the, as far as I know, the only big ammunition plant that was still going in 1864 was one in Richmond.
Selma, too, I think.
Well, Selma had something going? Yeah, they did, Selma, yeah. And it was so funny because you talk about morality. A lot of the guys wearing what was left of their gray uniforms were making arrangements with the women who were working in the ammunition plants. My God, you mean in the 1860s, people did that kind of stuff? Well, God bless them. I mean, you know... Because we're given this hogwash about the people years ago were, they wouldn't do that.
Oh, no, they were pure.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that.
There was never an out of wedlock birth in the United States before, say, 1926?
Yeah, oh, sure there wasn't. We know better than that. I mean, people, the human.
Well, you should see the look you get on some people's faces when you explain to them that Thomas Jefferson's wife was half sister to Sally Hemings.
Well, yeah, exactly. That was a classic situation there.
They had a common father and different mothers.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so when that's the reality, the Thomas Jefferson Sally Hemings connection makes a little more sense.
Yeah.
His beloved wife had passed away, and well, there was her sister. Now, he owned her sister, but, well.
Exactly.
I mean, when you say things like that to yourself, you find yourself just experiencing a wave of cognitive... Because we understand what the history of our country is, and we understand how bloody and brutal and heartless and, in many ways, unforgivable it is.
Yeah.
Thomas Jefferson, revered as among the greatest minds this country has ever produced, owned his wife's sister.
Yeah. He's...
Kick furniture and run out in the yard and holler for a little bit.
See, there were jokes about ethnic groups of all kinds in this country. I mean, there were Civil War jokes, one guy, especially the Irishman. The Irishmen and the Germans, because of the accent, they caught a lot of hell in the Union Army. A story about an Irishman who approaches his captain, and he says, "I got a letter from my wife, and she wants me to try to get leave and come home." And the officer retorts with, "I got one from your wife, and she says she doesn't want to see you again, Pat." Pat gets stopped by a buddy. He says, "Well, what did the colonel say to the captain?" And the guy says, "I don't know, but we're both bigger liars. I've never been married in my life." and the German 11th Corps of the Army of Potomac, yeah, they caught hell about their soldiering qualities. And here they are, the guys who in World War I and II were ranked among the best. But as I said, I know a guy whose father fought in the American Army in World War II, and he told his son what terrible soldiers the Russians were. Boy, take a look at a map and go from Stalingrad and Leningrad and Moscow, and how far was it to Berlin? Quite a bit.
Yeah, it's a hike.
And the Russian officers were every bit as cold-blooded as any Nazi, and they ran the Russian army.
Well, look, we're talking about Europe, Bill.
Yeah.
Cold-blooded and brutal is almost. You would almost make the argument that it was encoded into the DNA.
Yeah.
They look at the. You know how I am with classical antiquity. There's just read Caesar's commentaries on the Gallic Wars. There was no rule of fair engagement.
Chivalry? What are you kidding me?
Well, and then look at the mercenary companies that ravaged Europe in the wake of the Crusades. You got a whole bunch of heavily armed knights coming home with nothing better to do, and France was largely reduced into little more than brigandage. And the French crown couldn't deal with these companies.
Yeah.
They ruled in... Some king somewhere might claim title ownership of a region, a duchy, a dukedom, an earldom, whatever. But where the brigand companies were concerned, they were ruling on the ground. I mean, they'd ride in, burn down the church, steal all the food.
Yeah.
I guess you can say that all of humanity has that bloody streak.
Yeah.
But when you look at the history of Europe, you tend to think that they really did reduce it to a science.
Yeah, they had it down by the. When you read anything about the Second War and the Holocaust as we know it, is a huge tip of a very big iceberg.
Well, and speaking of the Holocaust, I've got a story here that's absolutely repulsive. Some Christian teenagers were bussed in to Albuquerque. Okay? Now, they didn't know squat about what they were doing, except that they were there to help protect and save the little fetuses.
Oh, yeah.
And they went there, they were paid, most of them were from California, and some of them paid up to $250 to attend the first-ever pro-life leadership camp.
Oh, boy.
Because Albuquerque is held to be the abortion capital of the Southwest and the late-term abortion capital of the country.
Oh, God. Where are they getting their information from?
From the little prions that scream inside their brains as their brains rot away. So... here we go, these ignorant teens who have been taught nothing except we've got to save the fetuses, descend on Albuquerque, New Mexico, which, having never been there, but I am told is, you know, all of New Mexico is just magnificent. And they go carrying signs that say ABQ, which I guess is the airport designation for Albuquerque.
Yeah, that would be about right, yeah.
ABQ... America's Auschwitz.
Oh, brother.
And they stood with their signs outside the New Mexico Holocaust and Intolerance Museum.
Jesus Christ.
The museum dedicated to never forgetting the real Holocaust. And you've got these kids in an ignorant religious frenzy comparing a woman's right to choose the workings of her own body to the Holocaust. And they even went inside the museum to hand out leaflets and to demand, this is where it gets really, really fun, Bill, demanding that the Holocaust Museum commission an exhibit comparing the real Holocaust to their objections to reproductive care. One of the kids told KOB Eyewitness News 4, since I just got here, we've been learning about Albuquerque's abortion laws since then, so I don't know too much.
Yeah, you don't know too much, kid, that's for sure. Because abortion was practiced for as long as anybody cares to remember. If you had I had a situation in about 60 before the changeover in the law. A friend came to me and says, you know, a lot of med students, because you hang out a case so much, and which is true. I used to, a lot of musicians and such, and I did talk to a medical student, and he gave me the name of an OBGYN guy who was a pretty well thought of, and he took care of it under the old D&C designation, which with the slang term was dusting and cleaning. I forget what the Latin medical designation was for doing this. And later on, my first wife's aunt and her mothers are all talking about great OBGYN man, and somebody mentioned the name of this guy and said, oh, he's the greatest, he's the best, and I almost fell over. Because he was, what he did at the time was illegal.
Yeah.
He did it, and he did a good job, and he did it right, and it shouldn't have been illegal, for God's sake. But it's been practiced. There's so many things that I've seen, and guys before me have seen that would sit and say, yeah, when did you learn of that? You were 20 years behind me. And having my dad's brother work for the fellas and get popped with a pound of reefer and pay a bribe, and that was the end of that, you know?
Right, right.
Because Hoover had to chase those communists.
Communists, dope-smoking communists.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, you know, the senator, one of the two Senator McCarthy's, the one who was named Joe, you know?
Yeah, the bad one.
What a lush. And then he went after Marshall. That's when he got himself in the sling. When he started going after people like that, well, you know, enough is enough. And I know Hammett, the writer, he served time because he wouldn't give up names to the House of American Activities.
Right, and yet fought in both the First and Second World Wars.
Both of them. And he was the second one. He was pretty old for that. What did he go out? He went to the Aleutians and ran a newspaper or something.
Yeah, I think so.
But the fact that he was willing to go, you know, at that age, because he had to have been well over 40 by that time.
Without a doubt.
Anyway, I'll let you go, but the fact that fascinates me about history is it's like either being on or watching a merry-go-round. And they go around once, and they come back wearing different clothes and carrying better weapons and finding new ways to do each other.
And still doing the same evil crap.
Yeah, the philosophy that drives people to it is the same. I just reached a spot in this book where they're finally, after how many years, the two fleets are going to hook up at Jutland, you know?
Right.
After sparring around and the Germans sinking the liners, you know. Of course, the Lusitania is the one that really put them in the wrong spot with this country. But from what I've been able to gather, the Lusitania might have been, since it was a British ship, it might have been carrying contraband. But you don't sink the ship with full of tourists and
right.
People's family.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, Bill, you have yourself a very good weekend.
You too.
And we will talk soon, I hope.
All right, sir.
All right, bye now. And that's our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, up in Cleveland. Let's just check out the KOB TV report on the Albuquerque Holocaust. It's not just being historically clueless. It's also being historically and culturally grossly negligent.
Abortion groups are busing teenagers into Albuquerque to help the political campaign to restrict abortions.
The group protested along central downtown with incredibly graphic photos. Chris Ramirez is there to tell us about the harsh words the protesters had for Albuquerque.
Well, you guys, those activists had signs comparing Albuquerque to a World War II Nazi concentration camp where millions of people died, most of them Jewish, and they did all this just feet away from New Mexico's Holocaust Museum.
ABQ, America's Auschwitz. It's hard for drivers to take their eyes away from a sign like this. Auschwitz was Hitler's largest...
Oh, by the way, while we're doing this, just one question, because I saw the banner there. Anybody? Can I get a spell check on Auschwitz? Because the banner, and I just noticed it. The banner says ABQ America's AUSHWITZ. It's a layer of disrespect on a layer of disrespect on a layer of disrespect on a layer of stupid. But then again, you know, they're fundies.
This concentration camp where he sent Jews from all over Europe to be put to death in gas chambers. The activists make the comparison because New Mexico, along with a handful of other states, has no bans on abortion.
We'll be here as long as we need to be.
And this is the Holocaust Museum in downtown Albuquerque. The manager said that they had to shut down a little bit early because those protesters were coming inside, they were passing out leaflets, and they were demanding that the museum open up an exhibit that compares the Jewish Holocaust to abortion.
We need to show the truth about abortion.
We learned this is not a homegrown movement. The activists on Central were bussed in from around the country.
Dallas, Texas.
Tempe, California.
Redlands, California.
I'm from California.
Torrance, California.
Torrance, California. Is this your first time in New Mexico?
Yes.
What do you know about New Mexico's laws?
You know, since I just got here, we've just been learning about it since then, so I don't know too much.
Out of state or not, the group claims they've gotten 25,000 petition signatures from Albuquerque residents who support their cause. But it's still hard for New Mexico native Joan Lamian Sanford to accept the comparison that Albuquerque is like a concentration camp from people who don't know much about our city.
We're hurt and outraged that these out-of-state extremists would come to our city and disrespect one of our most important landmarks like this.
This campaign is a political one, only this one is about people who don't live here trying to make changes for those who do.
Now, if that group is successful, a question will appear on the next city ballot asking if a ban should be placed on abortions after 20 weeks of conception. However, the ACLU has long maintained that such a ban would violate both federal and state laws. Reporting downtown, Chris Ramirez, KOB Eyewitness News 4.
You know, I'm actually kind of impressed with that reporting.
Remember, you're very...
I really am. It contained enough information for people watching the program to understand how graphically, profoundly ignorant these fundies are. And did so without any screaming. Just, this is our community, it's not theirs. And no, this is not the same thing as Freedom Riders. No. I don't think there were many Freedom Riders who went down into Mississippi who said, you know, I really don't know much about Jim Crow and segregation, but, you know, you know what I mean? And by the way, just, can we get a memo out to Abe Foxman over at the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith? Can we get a little outrage over this? Because it is outrageous. A woman choosing to terminate a pregnancy inside her own body is not by any stretch of the imagination the same thing as sentencing to death an entire cultural group of people for how they were born. Not even remotely. Standing there with their misspelled signs. I had a note in last night after the program from Beth down in Texas. She said, tonight I wasn't able to catch the program until the replay. Naturally, I was vastly cheered by your excoriation of crisis pregnancy centers. It occurred to me that you might like to see the exterior of the Catholic crisis pregnancy center next door to our clinic as viewed from our main entrance. And Beth attached a photograph. Oh, my God. The wooden fence is 8 feet tall, and we built it for good reason. The crisis pregnancy center crew used to stand along the property line and scream at our arriving patients. You know, scream in the name of Jesus. A single plastic savior on the side of their building failed to shame the devil out of us. So, if you squint at the photograph, you'll notice that there are now 3 crucified Jesuses nailed to their outside wall. The power of Christ compels you. The power of Christ compels you. The power of Christ... Oh, go away. a symmetrical display with one larger crucifix flanked by two smaller ones, as well as a colorful banner depicting the Blessed Mother dwarfed by a huge disembodied fetus floating in a glassy bubble. They also have another even larger Jesus on a stick mounted in a Christmas tree stand, which they prop up every morning at the entrance to our driveway. This depiction of the crucified Christ rocks a metallic silver loincloth and bears more than a passing resemblance to a Chippendale dancer. Chippendale Jesus. 50 years old I am. And there's a lot of crazy out in the world, but until you see a word like Chippendale Jesus, you don't realize that you've spent an entire lifetime not thinking about something like that, and you've got the rest of your days to contemplate Chippendale Jesus with a metallic silver loincloth. Beth continues, your mention of the national proliferation of CPCs reminded me of a piece I did several years ago detailing some of their methods of operation. And Beth has scanned the literature and sent it along. Some of the brochures make the claims you mentioned tonight, Bob, and others are even worse. Imagine telling a frightened young woman that if she has an abortion, her next baby will be twice as likely to die in the first few months of life. Wow, says Beth, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. Beth continues, wow, wow indeed. Well, you know, if you have an abortion, your next baby will probably die in its sleep. And you'll meet them both when you die and you go to the final judgment. And you'll have to say, yes, Lord, I killed that one, and then you killed the other one. Beth goes on, one day I came across an online discussion group for crisis pregnancy center managers and staffers. CPCs have a scam called Earn While You Learn, EWTN. I thought that was Eternal Word Television Network. But anyway. And some of them even make their clients bring notes from their preachers to certify church attendance in order to earn assistance with baby needs. There's also info on their fundraising schemes and other skullduggery. The forum went under password protection within 48 hours after I posted this story at Talk to Action. Most of the propaganda and other goods used by crisis pregnancy centers nationwide are produced by Heritage House 76. Put them on your radar. The menu on the left side of their page includes the merchandise they use to promote their Earn While You Learn scams. Beth says, this is probably more than you ever wanted to know about crisis pregnancy centers, but they do indeed form a noxious and insidious network. No, I wanted to know all of it, truly. Jack writing in. Yeah, AUSCHWITZ. The fundies forgot to carry the C. Marty noting, yeah, a lot of Southern Californians in there. Wave your donations in the air. And thanks going out profoundly to Sal for helping out this evening. And to Andrew, thank you very much. And that puts us at $360 to get out of the July hole and finish to the good this second week of August. Jack says, I agree. In addition, the same hypocrites that whine that the public schools are being used by liberals to indoctrinate their children have clearly indoctrinated those children and thrown them into public view to do those cowards' work. And charged them $250, ho-ho, to do it in the name of Jesus. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Preston.
Well, hey, Preston. How are you this evening?
I'm doing all right. I was actually just reviewing something of yours. Someone had posted something on my Facebook page about regarding, let me look this up real quick, Because I can, Bob Kincaid on mining, the ground, water, and air. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do.
So I looked up the link, and I'd forgotten or had missed that you were at the Bad River Ojibwe Reservation, is
yeah,
that right?
Yeah, twice. Well, I was at Bad River in December, and I was at Lac Coeur d'Alene in January, or was it February?
Excellent, man. That's great.
It was deeply inspiring. I'm not the same since I was there.
I can imagine.
It really does. When you get on the ground with, and I'm not trying to aggrandize myself. We know each other too well for me to try to pull any of that.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get on the ground and you get a chance to work in concert and common cause with people who are really engaged in a struggle, not for some sort of nebulous idea of environmentalism, but are engaged instead in a struggle for their very continued existence, you'll come away different. You will come away energized. You will come away understanding things that in ways that you never could understand them before. And in a way, I'll go ahead and say this, I feel sorry for the folks who operate those nebulous environmental so-called movements, because they're never gonna know what others who get down into the day-to-day struggle know. It will never be anything more than esoteric or aesthetic.
Who are you thinking of?
Sierra Club.
Maybe aspects of it, but, you know, there are people within it who very much recognize it as a, you know, very clear, not nebulous, struggle for survival. And for example, I saw Gasland 2, a screening of Gasland 2 recently.
Yes.
And, was rather floored by it. You know, a lot of it I was familiar with, but it's a powerful telling of the stories.
Oh, it is. It absolutely is. And yeah, that's the thing. This country is being crisscrossed now by various and sundry predatory corporatists who really don't care who they harm, as long as there's as long as the damages and the harms are externalized upon the people and not internalized by the shareholders. Well, you know, bully for them. Hooray for the quarterly profit and loss statement, whether it's Keystone XL or a busted pipeline in Arkansas or a fertilizer factory that blows up in Texas, or a refinery that goes up in Richmond, California, or Louisiana, or a mountaintop removal site that's poisoning people left and right in Appalachia, or fracking in Pennsylvania, or Illinois. There is, and I think this all fits within the paradigm, Preston, of the larger idea of peak energy. This is a wild-eyed chase to get the last of the wealth before the, well, what did Hunter Thompson say, big darkness soon come?
Yeah, that sounds right. Definitely. But quickly, back to the Sierra Club. And, you know, Sandra Steingraber had that open letter to the Sierra Club as to why she was distancing herself from it.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally hear and appreciate her critique.
Well, you know, she went further. She didn't just put that out there.
Okay.
I believe she's a native of Illinois. And if you go back and you read some of Jeff Bigger's reporting from the last few months, the Illinois legislature decided it was going to pass a fracking law. And Sandra Steingraber, and whom you kindly helped coordinate to get on this program for a discussion, and I will never forget it. Sandra Steingraber and Jeff Biggers and a number of others demanding an absolute moratorium on fracking, no fracking, because it cannot be proven to be safe. It cannot be proven not to be toxic. Tried their grassroots dead-level best to stop it. The Sierra Club, however, came in and said, no, you people don't know what you're talking about. We're the Sierra Club, and we're going to sit down with the fracking companies and craft a bill whether you want one or not.
Right, right.
They did that. And yeah. So, you know, I don't make a point out of just beating on folks for the fun of it, unless, yeah. Of course, it's like Louis Gohmert, because that is kind of fun. He's a nut.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're not sufficiently afraid of Hispanic speaking people, of Hispanic people, excuse me. And he said that in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
That's fun. Those stories, you know, banging on him's a little bit of fun.
Yeah.
But to just go at, no, I don't go after people like Sierra for the fun of it. When I mention things like this and the betrayals that have been involved, I do so having experienced them firsthand.
Yeah.
And I do so with a deep understanding that there's really, there's a great gulf, and it's even been documented by people far more intelligent than me.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, I've certainly been disappointed in some of their stuff, but I've also experienced some of their good work firsthand, and I just try to keep that in mind as well. And, for example, what I was getting at when I saw Gasland 2, afterwards, we have these weekly documentary film screenings that a friend of mine organizes, and there's often a discussion afterwards, and there was a representative from Sierra Club. They've got a anti-fracking campaign and going on, and she shared some thoughts and elaborated and, you know, gave me a lot of information regarding what's going on here in Colorado. You know, the fracking drilling is absolutely massive. And anyway, following her were a couple, was a gentleman in the audience who was kind of being very dismissive of Gasland, dismissive of the science behind it, kind of the lines from the industry about, oh, we've been doing fracking for such a long time. But that lady from the Sierra Club got the microphone back, and it was, you know, I was kind of irritated by that guy's position at first, but that it gave this woman an opportunity to just dismantle it. It was fun to see. And also during the Q&A, someone else brought up a charge against, or, you know, a partial reality regarding the Sierra Club. And that was, the question was, didn't the Sierra Club take a big check from maybe someone in the gas industry?
Yeah, about $10 million.
Okay. And there again, you know, she got to respond. I don't know all the ins and outs of that deal, but again, she was like, you know, mistakes have been made, but still, we're trying to make amends, or within this screwed up organization, try to accomplish something worthwhile. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like I said, I do take it personally, Preston, because, you know, we've got the 8 campaign going on.
Yeah.
And it is the first time that a bill has ever been introduced in the Congress that would end mountaintop removal.
Mm-hmm.
The Sierra Club told us we weren't smart enough to do that.
They sent you an email or what? I'd like to actually...
We pitched the idea. Grassroots activists pitched the idea of the 8 campaign and trying to get something going. And they said, well, we really don't think it's a wise thing to do in the political climate we have right now.
Mm. You know, they're probably getting infiltrators, too. I think that's important to keep in mind. I see a lot of that going on in organizations. And, you know, if they're infiltrating, you know, small protests, you know. Did you see that recent?
Oh, yeah.
What was that one? The woman who had gotten into...
D.C. protests against...
Sweatshop.
Yeah. Sweatshop labor.
You know, how dare people have an issue with us cramming people into these...
Yeah.
Incredibly...
Unfortunately, what we experienced was not a matter of infiltration. It was...
Well, I mean, the Sierra Club, you know, some of it's more, you know, centrist, you know, corporate-friendly, moderate members. Who knows? Maybe they're... I don't know. I would not put anything past them, that's for sure.
Yeah. They were, for instance, given, you might recall, $50 million by Michael Bloomberg to battle coal-fired power plants, which I wholeheartedly support.
Okay.
And when we went to them and said, listen, could we, you know, and they call it the Beyond Coal Campaign, President. And we said, you know, we'd like to make what we're doing, part of that, we'd like you to support what we're doing with trying to get this legislation going.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, oh, no, we could never do that. This can only be used for shutting down coal-fired power plants.
Mm.
And that that showed such a profound level of ignorance, because you see, mountaintop removal is more and more becoming an export market. So if their Beyond Coal campaign was more successful than they even ever imagined it could be, and they shut down every coal-fired power plant in the United States tomorrow, the mountains in our communities would still be blowing up. The toxins would still be raining down on the people who live near them.
Yeah.
And the trucks and the trains would still be leaving with the innards of our mountains in them to go to places like India and China and Russia.
Yep.
And I think what sits at the core of my objection is the fact that there is an elitism involved, that where people, we here hardly be intelligent enough to go out and get a bill that would end mountaintop removal without their help. But we did. And we continue to this day with next to no support whatsoever. I think they sent out one blast email a year ago asking for people to support the ACAC.
Mm. Well,
that's it.
So you got something. I'll celebrate that, at least. That's all. And again, I really appreciate your critique, and I learn a lot from it.
Let me suggest something for you, because I ran across this earlier today over on the Citizens Concerned About the Pinoki Mine Facebook page. I was not aware of this site, and I don't know enough about the site to know exactly where they are. I don't think this is a right-wing site. It is an article at a site called PolicyMike.com. That's PolicyMike.com, Preston.
Okay.
And the title is, Are Mainstream Environmental Groups Keeping Racism Alive? And the author of the piece is a woman by the name of Kat, with a K, Stevens. And it says, Kat grew up in the Finger Lakes bioregion of New York, occupied Haudenosaunee Confederacy territories, Cayuga Nation. Kat is a co-founder, and I'm waiting for the page to change. And maybe it will. But at any rate, she's a co-founder of a grassroots environmental group in her region. And she authored this piece, Our Mainstream Environmental Groups. Oh, here we go. A co-founder of the Finger Lakes Action Network, a board member for the Texas Environmental Justice Advocacy Services, a co-founder of the Wild Seeds Collective for Independent Media, and on.
Mm-hmm.
And so she writes this piece, Are Mainstream Environmental Groups Keeping Racism Alive? Here's the takeaway. Big green NGOs presented an exciting semblance of resistance that tells Americans they can make a difference just by clicking here, signing there, sending in monthly donations, watching a flashy video about an adventurous direct action that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to pull off, and making biannual trips to the White House to really give that darn president a piece of your mind.
See, I mean, right there, that sounds like a caricature to me, but go ahead.
Well, she says, these movements seem to do everything in their power to placate, pacify, and render ineffective their target consumers, white liberal Americans with a small sense of the hollowness of everyday life in capitalist America. By proposing simple and false solutions inside a framework of peaceful resistance, potential disruptors of the status quo are rendered ineffective while believing they are engaged in meaningful resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And she...
You know, I'm looking at this Sierra Club website right now, and it's flashy, and it's a lot of things, but it's also very helpful. And I really feel, I don't share, I think what she, her, how she's writing that is kind of a caricature of it, a misrepresentation, very divisive. And frankly, with all their flaws, I'm glad Sierra Club's out there, you know, and they can, it can very much serve as a stepping stone. It may not be the most radical, you know, I'm more apt to send my money to, you know, some of the local organizations that I'm more familiar with are the Bioneers. And
yeah. Like, well, you know, there's a study that came out a year or so ago, and I'm trying to think, it's the, is it Philanthropy Magazine? It's a journal for philanthropies, and it was a study partially commissioned or commissioned with the supervision of Big Greens. And the question presented was, why has the environmental movement become moribund? Why, you know, why are we still having to fight these fights? And I think one of the answers to that is because there's profit involved in the other side, and they will, the other side will kill, lie, cheat, steal, stomp grandmothers, kick kittens, whatever they have to do to make those profits, because that's the way capitalism works. I think that's one of the answers. But the answer they came up with is that the Big Greens are kind of sucking the air out of the room where the people on the ground who do the work every day are concerned. In other words, and their conclusion was more support needs to filter down from the treasuries of the Big Greens to the grassroots, to the grassroots activists who are getting the job done.
That'd be good. I like that suggestion.
And I think it's a valid critique. If I can find the article, I will. I'll send it along to you via email.
I'd be curious to check it out for sure. And you know, I think some other issues with the environmental movement include a lot of people not even recognizing its existence. In a sense, I mean, for example, I went to the Boulder bookstore recently, and this guy gave a talk on a book called "The Genius of Earth Day: How in 1972." Teaching unexpectedly made the first green generation. And he was surprised when he got into researching this that there's hardly any books on this event, which was like the biggest day of demonstration in U.S. history, involving estimated 20 million people or so. And it too, it was varied. There are aspects of it that were elitist and kind of, you know, greenwashy and co-optation, misappropriation, and all that. But still, there was a lot of authenticity and ingenuity and creativity to it. And I actually asked my dad about it. I would have been 3 at the time. And I was like, do you remember Earth Day? And he was like, remember it? Your mom and I took you kids to a park, and we picked up broken glass and litter.
Yeah.
It's like, right on, Dad. And so, and I don't know, there's a lot of people kind of very critical of even the notion of an environmental movement. I had a friend recently say something to the effect of the environmental movement serves power because the power elite can point to it and say, look how free we are, we have an environmental movement. I didn't even understand what he was arguing, but my response was, oh, the establishment likes the environmental movement, the one that they're constantly trying to subvert, that they mock on the airwaves, that they throw litigation at all the time, whose members they surveil. What movement are you referring to? I think the one I'm talking about deserves respect. And not to be in solidarity, critical solidarity, but solidarity nevertheless. I saw actually Book TV had a talk on a book called Green is the New Red and how environmental activists are being
painted as commies
and threats to national security, and they're passing all these draconian bills like the Ag Gag bill. Mother Jones did a cover story on that, but, you know, if people are trying to get photographs of some of these factory farms and stuff, if these bills get passed, they're facing years in jail and prison. again, there's resistance and people are becoming aware. And so we'll see where it goes.
Well, do you remember, Preston, a few years back when we went out to Las Vegas for the Horn? And
for the Netroots?
Yeah, for Netroots Nation.
Yeah.
Well, there was a panel there, and it was staffed by the brand new executive director of the Sierra Club, Michael Brune. Yeah, I know Michael.
I've seen him at Bioneers.
And it was also, the panel also included Majora Carter and a few other folks. And it was deeply frustrating. My AIC colleague Bo Webb was there with me, and so too was Matt Osborne. And we listened as this panel of so-called experts explained to us, and this is very nearly a quote: "The environmental movement will never spark a protest movement of similar effect or size to the civil rights movement." Never. The word never was used.
Hmm. Who said that?
Majora Carter, I believe.
Hmm.
And that was pretty tough to swallow. And, you know, we sat down and had we talked a lot about it. In fact, some of that informed the way we went about starting the IT campaign. Because, once again, the experts, the people who are smarter than the hillbillies, had told us that all of our efforts were for naught.
Hmm.
That our effects, because one of the things that we were in the process of doing and continue to this day is to try to explain to people that a so-called environmental movement is tied up in the well-being of human beings.
Yeah.
That absent humans on the planet, there's, well, it's the whole if a tree falls in the forest thing, isn't it, Preston?
Yeah.
And that if you touch people by making them understand that this is not some sort of esoteric debate, but this is a matter of life and death, as it is here in Central Appalachia, as it is around for people who have to live around fracking,
as it is everywhere.
Yeah, and as it is
climate change.
You know, if you have to live next to a refinery, like the 12,000 or so people who were sickened when the Richmond refinery blew up last year in Richmond, California.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to be pretty much everywhere, the salt on the air and the soil and the ground.
Well, the only thing is, it seems like that to us because we're the ones who live near it, Preston.
And I live near, like, Rocky Flats.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I'm very well familiar, and that's what I'm saying. You've got up-close and personal experience. I've got it. People who live with fracking have it. We can generalize that, but there are places.
Carter has it,
yeah,
you know.
There are places where it isn't happening. This kind of degradation is not happening in McMansion communities. It's not happening. It's not happening over top of Senator Joe Manchin's home or Senator Rockefeller's cabin in Pocahontas County, West Virginia. They're not doing it. You know, they're not doing it next to Mitch McConnell's, and frankly, they're not doing it next to Barack Obama either.
They're not doing it in Asheville. You know, they're not blowing up those mountains. Can you imagine them starting to, you know, at some point they probably will. They'll say it's some national security cause, and they'll start blowing up the mountains that surround Asheville, North Carolina. You know, in fact, they're working on legislation.
Well, you know the single most polluted national park in the country is Great Smoky Mountains National Park, right?
Okay. I did not know that, actually.
It is. And of course, even though it's a temperate rainforest in the toward the southern end of the Appalachians, it's still subject to degradation from things around it.
So that's sort of a salt.
Yeah, North Carolina is the single biggest user of mountaintop removal coal. Some of the worst air in the country. I mean, you think about bad air. Typically, you know, people go, "Well, Los Angeles smog, right?" No, some of the worst breathing conditions in the United States obtain in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Mm.
They've got asthma rates that are through the roof.
Mm. It's also a big banking headquarters.
Bingo, Bank of America.
Yeah. Real quickly, back to what's going on in environmentalism. There was actually a huge selling book called Breakthrough, From the Death of Environmentalism to the Politics of Possibility. It's a very manipulative book. It's very... They're very pro-nuclear power, and there's a lot about it that I dislike deeply. But they, so seduced some progressive people, and they've spread this meme throughout the political discussion of environmentalism is dead. And so there's that going on. But anyway, still, I'm saying it's very much alive.
It is, as long as we understand that it's not an esoteric thing, that it's existential.
True. We need to, feel it in our bones, because that's where it's there. It's in our blood. It's the air. Yeah, absolutely. I think people are becoming aware of that. I think sometimes we're frightened to become really aware of that. We almost want to keep some sort of psychological or emotional distance from it all, because it breaks your heart.
Well, it does. And for me to say that it's about human impact is not for an instance to suggest that I am unsympathetic or cold-hearted toward animal species that are threatened. Because I'm not.
These movements, I think, again, are about respect. Respecting the land.
Well, I mean, you'll see pitches go out via email. I get one about every 2 weeks, asking for money for a certain group and saying, if you'll send us $15, we'll send you a messenger bag with our logo on it, and won't you please help us save the wild wolves?
That's, speaking of that, that reminds me, a critique I have of Sierra Club, the mailings that I get from them are ridiculous.
Can you imagine how much resource money goes into that?
When you look at it, it kind of breaks your heart. Why they're the hundreds of the millions that they're spending on this stuff, and all this.
So do you get direct mailings, or do you just get stuff in your email inbox, or both?
For a while, I was getting it through my the mailbox, hard copies.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully, I was able to avoid the email barrage, but for a couple of years, I was getting this very thick mailers offering all this stuff, and I wish they, and I was thinking, why don't they, does it all have to be like, I can, tote bags, great, but useful, but how about a DVD or a book, too, or some educational tool besides branding? They're doing all this PR type stuff to a degree that needs to happen, but
well, and guess who's entirely. And guess whose model they're using, Preston?
The corporate model. And again, we're maybe there's some weakness.
Well, it's not just a corporate model. If I can interrupt just for a second,
please.
It's not just a corporate model. It is a right wing model. The right wing the direct mail was a model invented by the right wing long about 1968. Wasn't that Richard Viguerie?
Yeah.
And the return on if you get two positive responses out of 100, I think, that's deemed to be wild success. So imagine the cost of the postage, even if you're sending bulk rate. Mm-hmm. Imagine the printing costs. Imagine the externalized environmental costs of all of that paper printing.
Yeah. And another thing, if you're going to send out all this paper and all these words and all this writing, don't have it be the exact same thing over and over and over and over, providing no new current updates. That's why I like, speaking of the big greens, I think among them there are some that are worse than others or do more good. Natural Resource Defense Council, their mailing is useful, very informative. If you be a member for $10, and Robert Kennedy is involved with it, and they've had some successes. They drive the corporate executives crazy with all the lawsuits that they bring. So,
there's a continuum of just how pushy they're willing to be, and by pushy I mean actually doing the good work. For instance, Rainforest Action Network has done extremely good work relative to the banks that finance the coal industry. And they're pressing them and embarrassing them, and have created, it was partly through that I wound up in Germany and France a year ago talking to some of these big banks. Because they finance it, and if for instance we had a super brilliant forensic CPA to sort of dissect one of these mountaintop removal bond issues, you'd see that it was just a nasty, filthy little dodge, whereby the coal company gets money, and then the bank gets a percentage of the bond issue, but then they get money, cash on the barrel head, for doing the bond issue. So everybody comes away in good shape, even if it turns out the bonds aren't worth a damn. For instance, if you go and look at Alpha Natural Resources right now, you'll find that their share price is abysmal, and there's no real prospect for it getting any better. And it's not because Obama has a war on coal. It's because coal is a finite resource, and it's running out. Patriot is in bankruptcy. Patriot was created solely for the purpose of moving a bunch of pension obligations away from Arch and Peabody and into this little captive corporation that was designed from the get-go to fail, and Patriot's in bankruptcy, and they're ripping off coal miners of their pensions and their health care.
Yeah.
Now, yep. As a so-called tree hugger, I didn't have a damn thing to do with that, Preston. But the companies that these people showed up for with their friends of coal stickers and saying, you know, save a miner's job, well, you know, at a rally that we would hold, we didn't get their job. Patriot did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the whole thing's a scam.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And there again, the retirement heist. There's a book called Retirement Heist going, and the way United Airlines pilots, they were robbed, and some Cigna employees. And speaking of stock prices, I just want to point out, within that messed up system, the whole shareholder deal, there is some interesting shareholder activism going on. And I don't know if you noticed, but some, like, what's left of public employee retirement accounts, like the one in California, they divested from a lot of their fossil fuel investments and put a lot into solar and wind and stuff, efficiency measures, and have you heard of a company called Chipotle?
Oh, yes. I recently ate at one of their establishments. I had avoided it for a considerable period of time back when they were owned by McDonald's. But yeah. McDonald's got out, so I decided I'd give them a try. It's the best burrito I've ever eaten in my life.
Excellent.
And I was tickled to death. You know, they tell you very prominently when you walk in the door, our cheese and our sour cream has no recombinant bovine growth hormone in it. We won't allow it near our stuff.
That's right. They labeled that, and even more recently, they announced that how they're going to be labeling their non-GMO corn. You know, that Monsanto has been fighting labeling all this time, and they've beat back some of the legislation around it, but Chipotle became the first company, public fast food company, that says they're going to label their non-GMO food. I think Connecticut a few months ago became the first state that decided they were going to do it. But, you know, that brings to mind some of these so-called free trade agreements coming down the pike. There's one called the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yeah, you know, Sandra has raised that, and we've talked about it some. What a nightmare that is.
They're calling it NAFTA on steroids.
Yeah, I don't even know if that's fair. I don't know if that's a fair reference to the steroids.
NAFTA,
this thing
crack.
This is NAFTA on meth.
Yeah, yeah. And it would revoke those efforts by companies or by states or by city legislatures to try to label things or advance green energy. You know, at the country, at the national level, the country is pretty ridiculous when it comes to renewables and stuff, but some things going on in the cities are kind of remarkable. Like in Seattle, the way they've been cutting emissions and expanding mass transit here in Denver as well. It's certainly a mix. Like I said, we've got all these fracking issues going on. And a governor who actually, did this kind of publicity stunt, a total publicity stunt, drank
a glass, a fresh glass of fracking fluid. See, nothing wrong with it at all.
Yeah, that's an old trick's been done in West Virginia with coal waste too.
Really? Okay, the same PR firm, I guess, developed that one. Oy. But anyway, and so and Chipotle also, when they do serve meat, you know, they find ranchers that are more respectful to the animal.
It's so funny you would bring them up because I tried them because there's a Chipotle in Union Station in Washington D.C., which is about a block and a half from where we live when we're working up there, and they were the last restaurant open in Union Station because I had gotten off the show and walked down there. It was about 9:45 p.m. They were still open, and I got myself a steak burrito. The damn thing weighs about 8 pounds.
Yeah.
And it's $6.97.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's good through and through. I mean, and they offer you a choice. You can have black beans or pintos. And everybody's warned that the pintos are cooked with bacon fat, so naturally I went with the pintos. You know, bacon grease. What isn't it good on? But anyway, choice between black beans and pintos, and yes, there's corn relish that you can get on it, and for an extra buck and a quarter or something, you can get a layer of guacamole that I think comes from organic avocados. And again, the cheese and the sour cream, and your choice between shredded pork, barbacoa pork, carne asada beef, and you can just get it veggie. And I think at one point they had tofu. And I'm not, you know, I'm not such a carnivore that I won't sit down and you know, I can get after some tofu.
Yeah, sometimes they've got that onion green pepper mix.
Yeah, yeah.
Guacamole, and yeah, good stuff. And the kicker is their stock price is at over $400 a share.
You're kidding.
I'm not kidding.
That's hilarious. Well, not hilarious. That's also wonderful. We were across the river a couple of days ago, and Agnes looked at me and said, "What do you want for dinner?" And I said, "Do you really want to know?" Because I had brought, I actually stopped in Manassas and brought Chipotle burritos all the way home back to West Virginia when I came home last time because I was so impressed.
Great.
And she said, "What do you want for dinner?" I said, "Do you really want to know?" And she said, "Well, yeah." I said, "I want a Chipotle burrito." Because it really, you know, and 300 yards away is Taco Hell, okay?
Right.
And she I just said, "Don't even say the words." She said, "I wasn't going to. I knew it would hurt you." But you know, I think about things like this, and can we just speculate for a moment?
Well,
go ahead.
Well, real quickly, did you know that Chipotle started in Denver?
No.
Yes, it was founded about a 20-minute bike ride from where I'm at. And the other thing is, and here again, though, they're not perfect, and they certainly can be criticized on some things. For example, they were slow on the Immokalee worker strike, the people harvesting the tomatoes,
mm-hmm.
getting totally ripped off, and getting, you know, they approached Taco Bell, then Burger King, and they're getting pledges of, you know, a penny a pound more or something that no one would notice, but the workers would notice, and they'd notice being treated with respect, you know, livable wage. And Chipotle was dragging its feet, but on the eve of some big, they have like this festival that they put on called Cultivate, which is kind of cool. It's music, and they talk about sustainable agriculture and food, and it's a good time. But the Immokalee workers were talking about showing up at the festival, you know, and making their voices heard, which I was actually mulling that over. But Chipotle decided to go along with their campaign and pay them better, so they're getting better. They're getting better, even.
And see, this is one of those moments I said we were going to speculate.
Okay.
Wouldn't it be magnificent, for instance? I talk about not taking advertising and stuff, but if you can say that somebody is doing more good than they are bad and by a significant margin, you know, I wouldn't mind running an ad or doing a live talker like this for Chipotle. How much would this be worth to them? And yet the question is, how do you get out there and engage people in this process?
Yeah, it's making those contacts, the networking. Sometimes it seems like just so hard to achieve. Sometimes it just clicks, and it does happen eventually. A friend of mine, actually, the guy I mentioned who organizes the weekly screening of documentary films, he about 8 years ago was getting a lot of support from this little burrito company in Denver that just started out, Chipotle. and so they were giving him coupons for free burritos and some money to help rent the space, I think. And that didn't last, but it was there for a while and it was good. And yeah, it'd be cool to see Chipotle support progressive media. New Belgium Brewery. I mean, there, I think there's some possibility.
Yeah, with them, we'll just take it out in trade.
Yeah. And I actually met, I don't know if you've heard of Oscar Blues, that brewery.
No.
Well, they're doing a lot of things similar to New Belgium and a lot of solar and kind of recycling their leftover hops and using, I think it sends off methane as it decomposes, and they use it as a biofuel. They do a lot of community engagement. They send money to a place that helps people with developmental disabilities. And they advocate the bike culture and stuff like that. Anyway, that's another outfit. I met a bunch of workers from there, and a cool work culture for this crew as well. And it's good to see. Actually, I met them in Longmont. Boulder often gets the kind of label as being Colorado's progressive hippie
right
mecca. It's getting so pricey now, though. A lot of the kind of middle and working class people have been priced out, and a lot of them have gone to Longmont, actually, and they're kind of that whole kind of progressive
and see that's one of the curses of a profit based culture, is that when you've got a place that's sort of funky and it's got its own aesthetic,
mm-hmm.
the next thing you know the Biffs and the Muffies, Biff, Muffy, we must move to Boulder. I hear it's the very place to be this season. It's better than Stade.
Yep.
And the next thing you know, it's no longer funky.
Yeah.
It's just overpriced and faux hip.
Yeah. Actually, my neighborhood here in Denver is getting like that. It's definitely, you can see the class ticking up and the cars getting fancier and stuff like that. Because it, too, has been kind of it's gay friendly, and there's a lot of interesting food projects and music all over the place. And when
you walk into one of those situations on a lovely day, it just picks everything up. I mean, the whole place just feels more alive.
Yep.
I've experienced a little bit of that in D.C., just going out on my wanders. Apparently, D.C. has recently reopened along Florida Avenue, or off of Florida Avenue, a place called Union Market. And it's a place for purveyors of fresh, clean, decent foods, and there's an oyster company that tries to do it environmentally responsibly, and they're all there in one place, and it's delightful. The problem being, this goes back to what I think is a legitimate critique, and not so much a critique as a suggestion for a way to move forward. Until these concepts of labeling our GMOs and teaching people about GMOs reach into the more working class stratas.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I believe there are two classes. There's the coupon clipping class and working class.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if you make $500,000 a year. If somebody else is signing your paycheck, you're still working class.
Yeah.
And I think we would be better if we adopted that generally. But you've, and I said it the first time, when I saw a $16 a pound package of organic grass-fed frozen Montana cruelty-free beef in a Wild Oats store in Williamstown, Massachusetts. And I thought, you know, golly, I'd shop here all the time if I lived here and I could afford it. But we've got the Republican Party out there who are waging a full-scale war, and I've got a story in the stack this evening about another Republican congressman who is outraged by food stamps. These kind, and some of this, I suppose, is market dynamics and market forces. These kinds of products have got to find their way into the working class menu and diet.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, it's a sort of trendy elitism, isn't it?
Yes, you're right. You're right. And people are working on it. You know, I think some of these stores themselves have hear that critique, and so here in.
I mean, you've got I can't remember the guy's name, but he runs Whole Foods.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, doing the right thing, selling organic stuff, yada yada. And on the other hand, having a purple polka dotted blue screaming hissy fit about the evil socialism of Obamacare.
Yep. He actually was on Book TV a couple months ago. He wrote this book called Conscious Capitalism. He's a big time Ayn Rand devotee. And there's a lot about that book that I disliked and what he had to say. On the other hand, you know, he's certainly a mixed bag too.
Mackey, I'm being told in the chat room.
And then the people who run different stores, I think, may have their own kind of their own options, maybe, as to what they want to do with it. And I don't know. I happen to live across the street from a Whole Foods. Before it was a Whole Foods, it was a Wild Oats. And Wild Oats was actually, that was founded in Boulder. Whole Foods was founded in Austin. Before it was Wild Oats, it was Alfalfa's, which was an even smaller one that was also founded, I think, in Boulder as well. And before that, it was a Safeway. So I'm glad it's not a Safeway. I have a larger grocery store that I visit sometimes about six blocks from me called the King Supers. It's often been called the Queen Supers, though, because, again, this is a very gay-friendly neighborhood.
How did I know?
As a Whole Foods, that what it is right now, the building itself is kind of more human scale. You know, it's not a mega box. It has a parking lot, but just one row, and it probably fits maybe 50 cars total.
And you know, News Ninja Gene sent me a couple of stories in the last few weeks. One about Publix out of Florida, and I think I mentioned on the program the other night. And now there's another story out what's the name of the company? Winco, a small employee-owned grocery store chain based in Boise, Idaho. And both of those are being hailed as Walmart killers because they've got lower prices and better benefits for their workers than Walmart does.
Mm-hmm. Costco's like that.
Yeah.
Actually. Glad to hear.
You know, the models are out there. The question is whether the question is about the nexus between Wall Street and these models. Because, for instance, Wall Street routinely punishes Costco for not operating on the same remorseless, heartless, soulless model that Walmart does.
Yeah.
You know, demanding of Costco the same kind of earnings reports that Walmart generates. But of course, Walmart couldn't exist without food stamps. And yet, here's this goober. What's his name? Mark Wayne. That really is. That's his first name. Mark Wayne. Markwayne. Mark Wayne Mullen of Oklahoma has declared that we've got to get rid of food stamps because he saw some fit people using the SNAP card in line at the grocery store. I was talking about making sport of Louis Gohmert earlier. Remember, he had a hissy because he said he had constituents complaining that food stamps were being used to purchase Alaskan king crab legs when the constituent couldn't eat nothing but hamburger.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this is complete and utter BS, right,
again,
Preston?
The strategy, it's caricature. Again, they're so good. And, And it's the maker and taker. They've got several books. You know, I love book TV, but we've spoken about this before. Heritage Foundation, that corporatist think tank, and AEI, another corporatist think tank.
Right.
They have set up camp on book TV. Last weekend, they had some young Republicans gathering, or the Eagle Forum gathering, at the Heritage Foundation. That group, it's been headed by Phyllis Schlafly for the longest time, who's like...
Oh, what, Eagle Forum?
Yeah, yeah. She's the right wing's answer to Gloria Steinem, in a sense. And,
yeah, in a really twisted sense, Preston.
Yeah. PBS actually did a really good documentary on the women's movement. And again, another movement that's taken different twists and turns and all that, but really interesting to learn about. I think it was called the PBS, something about makers, women makers, or something like that. Anyway, I'd learned so much about what Gloria Steinem was up to and what Phyllis Schlafly was up to, the whole Equal Rights Amendment movement, what happened with that, the issues around reproductive autonomy, and it was interesting. I saw a piece on, I think, Sojourners, or from a group called the Christian Left, and they had this article entitled, which I think they got from Sojourners, it was something like When Evangelicals Were Pro-Choice. It was back in the 70s, and a lot of these Christian organizations were, pro-choice, and they had passages from the Bible as to why, and they understood it. But again, there's a movement that was kind of co-opted and turned into something else, this tool of control, which, if they really got their way and they shut down all the Planned Parenthoods, there's a study recently that estimated that there would be an additional 700,000 or maybe more abortions due to the loss of that important institution.
Right.
So their whole pro-life argument, again, it's a misnomer.
Well, I don't know, Preston. I tend to think that they know these things. I guess because I'm a cynic. This is about control.
The directors of it, the directors of the movement, know these things. I think the followers are maybe well-meaning but misinformed, or I don't know.
Useful idiots.
There you go.
Let's see, where is it here? Rand Paul. Rand Paul, and you can tell when this stuff starts. The reason I say that they know what's going on, this is not about ending abortion. What these people really are about is disempowering women. Okay.
Yeah.
Rand Paul did an interview recently, in which somebody asked the interviewer asked him about Griswold versus Connecticut. And it's been my position all along that Roe versus Wade is not the goal of these right-wing anti-women campaigners.
Mm-hmm.
Griswold is, because Griswold establishes the right to privacy, not Roe. Griswold establishes a woman's access to contraception, not Roe. It's contraception they're after, because if they can strike down that right, then they can drive women back into the kitchen. Because at the end of the day, that's what this is about. There is a fundamental philosophical difference in this country between people who believe that women are fully functional, 100% equal members of society, and a significant, noisy minority who thinks that they need to shut up, kick their shoes off, get pregnant, and get back in the kitchen where God wants them. Remember, most of these fundamentalists and their cults, I mean, you can call them religions if we want to, but most of these fundamentalist cults adhere to the literal truth of that verse from Flip Floppians, Glad Handians, I can't remember, that says that a woman is to submit unto her husband. And in point of fact, there's even a news story out in the last 24 hours that even though you know they're out there, you're shocked when you see them. A member of the Republican Party from Arkansas, a freshman Republican named Tom Cotton, who is making quite a name for himself in wingnut circles, has stated that, well, he says, I've been asking women two questions. My first question was, what is your greatest fear in life? Uniformity characterized the responses. Watching my husband walk out on me, losing my lover, getting a divorce. And so he draws from this to say that women are the problem in divorce.
Mm.
Not kidding.
Yeah. You mentioned Rand Paul a moment ago, and we were talking about Mackey. I mentioned his book, John Mackey. He's actually going to be speaking this weekend on Book TV about his book, because they're going to be covering the Freedom Fest, you know, that libertarian, right-wing libertarian get-together. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but...
What's it called again?
Freedom Fest.
Oh, dear God.
Yeah, and they've got a lot of...
You probably can't see the stage for all the Gadsden flags.
Yeah, but again, but when Book TV is good, it's phenomenal. You know, they'll air a talk by Amy Goodman. I recently saw Jeremy Scahill talking about Dirty Wars from the Free Library of Philadelphia. Something else. And, yeah, interesting. Who else recently? Well, here in Denver, actually, at my Unitarian church, which is very different from some of these other churches.
Oh, by a long shot.
Oh, yeah. We hosted a speaker on climate change, and he's a state representative from Iowa named Rob Hogue. He just wrote a book called America's Climate Century. And going into it, I wasn't, you know, I was like, how moderate is this going to be? He's a politician, whatever. And he was phenomenal. I was so glad I made it to this talk. And, boy, he was not mincing words or showing Politico, you know, moderation or whatever. It was hard-hitting.
Right after it.
Yeah. And so, again, good work going on in all sorts of places. Anyway, I'd be curious to hear. I'm sure you've got other callers lined up, and just wanted to touch base with you all.
Well, I'm glad you did. I enjoy our Friday conversations. Well, heck, I enjoy our Monday and Tuesday and any other time conversations too, Preston. And by the way,
likewise.
As we were speaking, I went and found that report on environmental movements and the grassroots, and I have emailed you the link.
Okay, I appreciate it. I'll check it out.
All right, good to talk to you, Preston. You have a wonderful weekend.
Likewise, you too.
Hey, if you get out to around a Chipotle, you know, enjoy a burrito for me.
Will do.
All right, thanks.
Sure thing. Bye bye.
That's our buddy Preston, the Horns resident optimist, calling from Colorado. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
This caller from Colorado.
Hey, Kevin, what's happening?
Not much. On that link that you mailed Preston, did you mail him the actual manifest? Fracking manifesto?
No. I sent him the report on funding the grassroots. It's a report from, I think, Philanthropy Magazine or something like that.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of the link to the fracking manifesto. I actually looked it up while you were on the phone with him, and it's something like Fracturing Illinois, I think. WWW Fracturing Illinois or something. But I am... her name's Sandra Silverstein, right?
Sandra Steingraber?
Steingraber, yeah. Yeah. And that fracking manifesto, you had sent me that link about a month ago, I guess. And I immediately signed that and just saved it in my computer. I was so impressed with the way it was written and what it said and, you know, and what you were talking about. what you and Preston both were talking about with Sierra Club and the mailings they do and the fundraising they do could, you know, it is, as Preston said, you know, you gotta have a little criticism for the so-called environmental movement, because it's one of our downfalls. You do have to do some fundraising, but when it gets to the point of being a business instead of a cause, that's kind of where I take a little exception to it, I guess, because there are people out there like you in the Appalachians and the people up in the Pinokies that are fighting for their lives. It's not a business to them. It's a fight for their life, literally. And
yeah,
you know,
and the difference between Appalachia and the Pinokies, for instance, Kevin, and the thing that I found so inspiring being up there is that they have a chance to stop the harm before the harm starts on them.
Yep.
Whereas we're trying to save what's left.
Yep.
And I just I have to live in a reality world, and I have to acknowledge that that is the reality here. We're trying to save what's left. And frankly,
yeah,
we don't know what's left.
No.
But people like my friend Mike Wiggins, tribal chairman of the Bad River Band up there, people like my friend Pete, my friend Bill Hart, all of the wonderful people that I met up there, are, you know, they know what they have, and they are damned well not going to sit there and just take it. I mean, it was a joy to me. There's a wonderful little independent coffee shop there in Ashland, Wisconsin, and my buddy Pete took me in there and just walked over to the water pitcher and poured me a glass of water and said, "Wait till you taste this." Now, it's not very often that somebody pours you a glass of water and says, "Wait till you taste this." Because, you know, water really doesn't have a flavor.
Nope.
But he was absolutely right. It was magnificent. And what it was water that they go and gather every day for making their coffees and just serving glasses of water from artesian wells that bubble up at high pressure from underneath the ground, not far at all from the Pinokies themselves. Well, that goes away, and that is worth struggling for. That is worth being unwilling to give in or to compromise for. When you see, as I did, the source of the Bad River at Lake Caroline, and you see how clean and clear and, yes, pristine it is, and you know that that's going to be running yellow and the rocks will be turned red, and it will all be poison, that is worth struggling for. And that's what I find so inspiring up there.
Yep. And the knowledge that when it goes away, it can never come back.
Right. And that's the one thing I said when I got a chance to talk up there. I said, you only get one chance to make the right decision, and you're being asked to trust people who have a long history of being untrustworthy.
Yep.
You will not put the lid back on this box if you allow it to be opened.
Nope. And I suppose there's several bands of Native Americans that have this philosophy of looking out to seven generations.
It's almost ubiquitously operational, as far as I know.
Yep. And you know, you and Bill were talking about the Europeans and the warlike culture they had. Well, you know, what's that thing missing from there? That's it. If you're looking out seven generations and thinking to yourself, my great-great-great-grandkids are going to have to inherit what we leave them, you might not be so quick to go to war, you might not be so quick to do a lot of things, but when you're only thinking about Generation U,
or not even thinking about that, just thinking about the next quarterly profit and loss statement.
Right, right. Well, that goes back to what I call Generation U, thinking about yourself and no one else. Because if you're just thinking about the next P&L statement coming out, that's all that matters. And if that's all that really matters with you, you're a very shallow human being to begin with. Then to pass it on from generation to generation, you know, it just really is sad to watch. I took note of you and Preston speaking about the conservative think tanks, and I took a little bit of joy in thinking conservative and think in the same word doesn't exactly fit.
Oxymoron, warning.
Yeah, but, you know, wanting to take women back to being in the kitchen and how that senator could draw or congressman could draw that thing about a woman being her greatest fear being her loser and losing her husband and her lover and that, and how that proves that, you know, we got to take them back to they're the problem with the divorce, and we got to take them back to the kitchen. And then you got a woman like Shafley who preaches that stuff, but she heads this organization. And I just wonder if the hypocrisy of that isn't lost on people, that while she's teaching this, let's take women back to the 1820s, you know, she's heading the Eagle Forum. And it just has always kind of struck me as being very hypocritical. You know, you're asking other women to make the sacrifice, but you yourself are hitting this big forum. And, you know, I just wonder if it's not, you know, why people can't see that just doesn't make any sense. Would she want to give that up for herself? Obviously, the answer is no, because if she did, she wouldn't be doing the job she's doing.
Well, but remember that, you know, this again, these think tanks are profit oriented too. They may be qualified as a 501c whatever educational organization, but that is at best, that's a very thin veil, Kevin.
Oh yeah, and unfortunately, I see that in a lot of 501c3s because of the fact, in a way, they do have to operate as a business model. But one I was a board member of got that way. And, you know, when you stop thinking about the clientele you serve and the actual meaning of why you're there, and then just begin to run it as a business, you know, that's to me when you should lose your 501c3. But I'm not the one that makes those laws, unfortunately, because I definitely take the tax exempt status away from the church, because that's the biggest purveyor of let's run it like a business. And, you know, I guarantee you a lot of churches would go away if you took the 501c3 status away from a lot of these big churches. Or, well, not the mega churches. They'd still find a way to survive. But a lot of the middle-sized churches, they'd go away because that's all they're there for. When you start making them pay taxes on their property and their people and everything else, they just would go away. And I never have understood why we, as a country that said there's a separation between the church and the state, why we ever allowed that to begin with. Why you bring back taxes, why you give churches a tax-exempt status. I understand the lobbying by the churches, the church people to do it, but I just never have understood why we as a country allowed that when the founders came over here escaping persecution. I understand that you turned around and did the same thing themselves, but, you know, like Bill says, I guess history does repeat itself, and, you know, it is kind of fascinating to see where we haven't learned, but then again, I do agree with you. 70 years is a very short time, and would it not be different if we lived 200 years? I don't know the answer to that, because I don't...
I don't think any of us do, Kevin.
Well, I almost wonder if it wouldn't be Bob, because knowing humans and being humans, you have to take the greed out of the human being. And for some of us, that's not that big a deal to do, but for, you know, the top 10% of us, I'd say, in terms of what you talk about is the 1%, you know, and I'd extend it out to about 10%, you know, that's all they want is money, more, you know.
All the way to the very last, to the very end, more money, more profit.
Yeah, and you can't take it with you. So, you know.
Yeah, I still haven't seen any hearses pulling U-Hauls.
No. And I attended a man years ago that was very rich. He was dying of cancer or emphysema, something like that, and I had to take oxygen bottles out to him every so often. And, you know, it was such a strange sense of being around him because you just didn't get that feeling of even dealing with his imminent death. You know, I don't know how to describe it. It was just such a weird feeling, like, you know, it was almost palpable, the sense of, you know, I want to take it with me, kind of thing, you know. And I felt sorry for the man because you lived your whole life and, you know, that's all you based it on. And so.
Yeah, and then, I find it fascinating, or at least informative, to know that most of the pharaoh's graves, you know, they were buried with gold and all their riches. Most pharaoh's tombs had been looted before they'd ever been in the dirt for 500 years.
Yep.
Even they couldn't take it
no.
with them.
Nope. And the sad part is when you think about even back then, 6,000 years ago, people wanting to be buried with that, and what those riches could have done to the living for the ones that were still left, and how it just was buried away for 1,000 years, waiting 2,000 years, waiting for people to discover it, or 500 years, or 100 years, or 50 years, you know, but it wasn't used for what it should have been used for. And so I wonder if we lived to be 200, then there'll be a day, if we don't destroy ourselves before then, that we'll develop the technology to start living out longer and longer. And I wonder if that'll make any difference in the human condition, because when I see some of these groups, like you and Preston were talking about, and like that Freedom Fest Foundation that he was talking about having that convention this week, you know, they still haven't gotten it. We're all in this together. And to take away help to people that are less fortunate than you eventually takes it away from yourself, because it takes away your humanity. And you look at these groups, Tea Party, Patriots, or whatever group, almost all of them you can say are filled with hate. I don't know of one of them that isn't at least covertly racist. And most of them were overtly so, but that's the one thing you can say about them. They're filled with hatred. And, you know, that's just something to remember for people, is don't allow your hatred to get the best of you, because these people aren't happy. And they're out to destroy other people. And that's their chief goal in life now, to take away from others. I try to remember that when I get too angry at them, because that's, you know, they're the ones really suffering in the long run from their hatred, and they're just trying to take it out on us. And
Yep. Well, Kevin, you have yourself a good weekend, my friend.
Yes, sir, you too. And, yeah, I'm going to have to try that Chipotle's. I've heard about it. I knew it was formed out here in Denver.
I'm not kidding. It's a 5-pound burrito, I think. I was excited. Yeah. I brought three back, one for each of us there at the apartment, and I was tired when I got back, just carrying that bag full of burritos. Damn, things are heavy.
Man, well,
but they're also yummy.
So, you have a good weekend.
All right, you take care, Kevin. Bye now. Kevin calling from Colorado Springs, and we move onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Yeah. It's Larry, then.
Hey, what's happening, Larry?
What's going on? Well, you know, we've got to get, far be it for me to do the inviting, because I'm not the head of the Skype chat, but I'd certainly like to bring Preston and Sandra, and Kevin hasn't been in for a while. I'd certainly like to bring them into the Skype chat. That would be a really, we could expand the discussion and stuff. How are you? Are you all right?
No, I'm hanging in.
Good, good. I wanted to mention that I've been listening to the conversation. I've got a lot to say, but maybe I'll call in next week. But I saw the movie Promised Land with Matt Damon in it.
Oh, yeah?
And there was something that I didn't understand. It talked about fracking and what the larger company did is it brought in a sort of a phony opponent to make the environmentalist argument look bad, and I was wondering why they would do that sort of a thing. They had the big company that wanted to come in and do all the fracking, and it was in the middle of a campaign for the townspeople to support the fracking, but somebody from the larger company sent in a sham environmentalist group, and I was wondering why they would do that sort of thing. Does that thing go on in a real life scenario situation?
Well, it's like Preston was talking about, Larry. I mean, there are infiltrators, and any group working with social justice, civil rights, environmental justice, women's rights, reproductive rights has to constantly labor rights. They love to infiltrate labor, and you can always tell the ones who are the infiltrators will sooner or later give themselves away, because they're the ones who are saying, hey, let's go put some bricks through windows, and all the peace people turn around and go, what the are you talking about?
Uh-huh. But I know people here in Berkeley who will form a breakaway group, and they'll say, we want to form a breakaway group and do some, you know, busting windows and stuff. And I don't understand that, because that discredits the whole, you know, when Occupy was doing its thing in Oakland, you know, that kind of thing. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, okay. And the other thing about what we have in Berkeley, we have a Whole Foods that I shop at sometimes. We also have the Berkeley Bowl, which is the big shopping place, you know, grocery store here in Berkeley, and both of these people were virulently anti-union, and they finally, you know, and the thing about John Mackey is that he treats his own employees very well, according to the employees. I mean, he takes care of them, but if you're an employee in that store, you can't say anything about unionism, but he'll take care of his own people, and they give really good service. So, you know, I guess that's a way to keep, you know, to get people to come into the store and to get business by treating your own employees very well. But he certainly did lobby against the Employment Free Choice Act, and he got picketed here in Berkeley. We also have, you know, other stores, but what's been happening, I don't know how Mackey started, and I do remember Wild Oats because we had a branch here. About the women's movement, it's interesting, as Kevin pointed out, and I'm glad that he astutely pointed it out, that you've got a lot of these people who are Republican women and what have you, who are professional women, who are, you know, pushing the quote-unquote, now I don't think they have a monopoly on family values, by any stretch of the imagination, because I have family values, but they're different from those kinds of family values that they're referring to with their symbolism. But they're out there, you know, earning their living and trying to do what they can do to better their life financially. They're not staying at home because they can't. If they stayed at home, they wouldn't have a life. So, but they're out there saying that other women should stay at home. So, like Kevin said, I don't understand it. But I don't understand it either. It seems like it's hypocrisy, but I can understand. But it seems to me that that just points out how the sexist and racist and what racism and sexism have done to this country, and how this country has been twisted for so many years. About you were talking about the Bad River group. Is that the Menominee tribe up in?
No. It's the Bad River Band of the Ojibwe people.
Okay. Well, I wish I had a big charity ability. I'd give money to all these people.
I know you would, Larry. Your heart is good.
I'd give something. I'd give my time. But
no, we lost Larry. But I think the spirit certainly comes through. It's time to get out of here. At any rate, the time has flown by this evening, as has the week. And it does so because of you, because you're interested, you care. Thanks again to Andrew and to Sal. Your help was monumental. It was the only help. And let's see, that leaves us. Monday evening's fundraising goal will be $510. To try to get out of July's hole and get level with August. So, over the weekend, if you hear this on the rerun stream, bear in mind, we haven't gotten there. Any help is always appreciated. And thanks so much for the conversation that makes all of this worthwhile. It wouldn't be any fun at all if it was just me. Thank you very, very much. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room, our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox in Australia. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Almost single-handedly saved progressive radio by creating on the Internet the White Rose Society in action for more than 10 years, more than a decade now. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHECT, ACHECACT, .org, ACHECT.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Rick Smith is next on the horn. You'll have a great weekend. Catch you Monday.